You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Talk Nation Radio.
Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion of politics as if the people mattered. I'm David Swanson. This week on Talk Nation Radio, we'll talk about Ireland and war and peace. We are very privileged to welcome Barry Sweeney, who is a member of the Coordinating Committee of World Beyond War, of which I'm the director. Barry is based in Ireland, but is often in Vietnam, as he is at the moment, and in Italy. His background is in education and environmentalism. He taught as a primary school teacher in Ireland for a number of years before moving to Italy in 2009 to teach English. His love for environmental understanding led him to many progressive projects in Ireland, Italy, and Sweden. He became more and more involved in environmentalism in Ireland and has now been teaching on a permaculture design certificate course for 5 years. More recent work has seen him teaching on World Beyond War's war abolition course for the last 2 years. Also in 2017 and 2018, he's organized peace symposia in Ireland, bringing together many of the peace anti-war groups in Ireland. Barry is currently living in Vietnam, although he still continues his role of country coordinator for World Beyond War in Ireland. Barry Sweeney, welcome to Talk Nation Radio.
Thank you very much, David. Delighted to be here and honored to be interviewed.
Thanks very much for coming on. I don't know if we can cover the whole history of Ireland and war and peace, but we're going to try. And of nonviolent tactics, boycotting is something that comes from Ireland, right?
Sure, David. That's a funny one, you know, Ireland and the Irish people, we would have that sort of stereotype of being, you know, the fighting Irish and all that. And yet, we do have some very important non-violent moments in our past. Boycotting, as you say, was born in Ireland in the 1800s, 1880s. It was Captain Charles Boycott was a British landlord, an absentee landlord. Exorbitant rates, and all the locals revolted against him and just stopped buying from him and stopped paying him, and that was the birth of boycotting. And it's a little celebrated thing in Ireland. It's nobody even you're taught it in secondary school, but it's not a thing of pride that we have one of the most successful non-violent direct actions currently used in the world. Instead, as with most countries, we romanticize the fallen dead and the rising of 1916 or the rising of 1798. When the reality is our independence was won at the table, talking at the table over in Westminster in London. These types of important moments of peace, you know, really need to be spoken about more and appreciated more than they really are, not just in Ireland, but around the world.
Well, the peace may have been won around the table, but I've seen even current books. I picked up a book called Fatal Path by Ronan Fanning that argues that it was all about the threat of terrorism. Without the threat of terrorism and engagement in terrorism, Ireland would never have won anything.
No, absolutely not. Through the long history, through all the various different centuries, any rebellions we had were crushed within days. They never had any success. When we really started to gain traction, in fact, Karl Marx wrote a very interesting paper on this, was not long after the famine in the 1840s. And it really brought home to the Irish people the position they had within the British Empire. And from that was born the Land League, where they were looking for the three Fs. Was that fair rent? I can't remember all three of them now. And that was when the people of all of Ireland actually really bought into it. All the other rebellions, 1798, it was the aristocrats, 1916, again, the upper class. The Land League and the boycotting, that was of the people, that was grassroots, and that was much harder for them to stop. And that was where it really began to gather, home rule really began to gather traction. And that built and built. We then had a rebellion in 1916, which was crushed in days. And a few years after that, we won our independence over in London in 1921. Although it was offered to us with the country being divided, so we then, of course, had little support to see would we accept this treaty of a divided Ireland or not a divided Ireland. And the political party that would not accept the treaty, of course, when they won the war, accepted the treaty. And so we have our divided Ireland still.
Indeed.
And Northern Ireland then has a much more complicated history. You know, that was full on, you know, Catholics weren't allowed to own property, vote, there was gerrymandering, there was second-class citizenship. And while there would be split division or split opinions on whether the IRA were right to, you know, take violent actions, the reality is once that sort of stuff starts, it's just tit for tat. It goes over and back. You know, my uncle died, so I'm going killing somebody, and it goes over and back in an endless cycle. And it just never breaks until the sides actually sit down together and begin real reconciliation with real commitment and courageous leaders. And, you know, it's real reconciliation. There's a lot of work in it, and Northern Ireland is in a much better place now than it was in the past. And there's still work to be done, but Ireland has certainly it has made massive steps forward, at least within its own violent nature.
And how did peace finally come about after years and years of ongoing violence? This is something that Mairead McGuire, who's on our advisory board, was a part of.
Yeah, exactly, yes. People got sick of it, you know, because there's just no way out. I think that was a large part of it, just the general population got sick of bombs in shopping centres and cars being blown up and civilians dying, and the public turned on them. So John Hume and Mairead McGuire and a number of other, you know, very strong, brave people in Northern Ireland, very vocal people. They led the way, and the people got in behind them. Until the IRA started calling ceasefires, they were broken a few times the first few years, and then Bill Clinton got involved, and they sent over some American politicians to help us negotiate between the different parties in the North, and they had the Good Friday Agreement, which still holds to this day. But it took, you know, a lot of commitment from a lot of different people, and it took for the public to want it to happen, you know, to want the violence to stop.
Yeah. It almost seems like a model for the world, or for the war-making nations of the world that keep trying war as a means to peace, or supposedly a means to peace for 100 years since the war to end all wars. And when Ireland gave up on violence and tried peace as a way to get to peace, it seemed to work much more quickly.
Funny that, and that's the actual truth of it. Like, if you want violence to stop, like, the only way to do it is to stop fighting and to sit down and start talking and start the real conciliation and appreciation of the feelings on all the different sides and the hurt on all the different sides, and to be empathetic and to reconnect as a community. We are just one community. It's quite a small island.
Yeah.
So it takes that type of honesty to say, look, we just don't want this anymore. And the vast majority of Ireland do not want a return of the violence at all.
And so what happens now with Brexit and Northern Ireland leaving the EU, but Ireland not leaving the EU?
That is a mighty fine question, David. There are continuous talks going on at the moment between the Irish Prime Minister and the British government, the Irish Prime Minister and the European Union. The British government don't really appear to have any sort of a plan, so it's difficult to say what's going to happen. There's certainly murmurings of a united Ireland again, emanating both from the North and from the Republic. What's actually going to happen is very difficult to say. Will there be a hard border again with troops back and checking cars and buses like it used to be when I was growing up? It's very, very difficult. There are so many options out there, and there seems to be very little clarity of where anybody's going.
Indeed. We're speaking with Barry Sweeney, who's a member of the Coordinating Committee of World Beyond War and based part of the time in Ireland. Barry, Ireland is supposed to be neutral in terms of other countries' wars, yet has U.S. troops using Irish airports in apparent violation of that neutrality. Is that still a problem? Is it a problem with Ireland being part of the European Union, or does that make it okay? What's the situation?
Well, the situation is, since the war in Iraq started in 2003, over 3 million American battle troops have gone through Shannon Airport, which is a civilian airport. It doesn't have reinforced runways. It doesn't have reinforced hangars. It has a big glass front. It's not designed for taking military planes carrying munitions and bombs and things like that. You know, accidents happen, planes crash, things explode. It's very dangerous to the civilians who use that airport, and it's absolutely reckless behaviour by our government. There's Shannon Watch is the name of the local activist group there who keep a very close eye on what planes come in and out. Literally every day they're at that airport taking pictures. They then track the planes, they get the numbers, they see where they go to. Last week there were a number that came from Tel Aviv, went straight through Shannon to Washington, loaded up whatever they were loading up, and came back the same route, stopped off in Shannon again, and went back to Tel Aviv. What they're carrying, we don't know, because the government doesn't let anybody actually search the airplane. There have been planes that have gone from Shannon to Guantanamo. You know, so whether they are involved in renditions, we don't exactly know, because, again, we're not allowed on the planes. Anybody who has tried to search the plane has immediately found themselves behind bars. And our stance on neutrality, well, it has changed and morphed many, many times. Like, it first really kind of came on the scene in 1798, a long, long time ago. Oh, no, it's not 1798, sorry, 1786. When there was an incident over in India where two Spanish boats commandeered two British boats, and the British wanted to start a Spanish war, a war with Spain. And Wolfstone, who would have been a very prominent aristocrat in Ireland at the time, made a preemptive speech to the government along the lines of asking, you know, do Ireland really want to be used for Britain's gain? You know, we gain nothing by a war between Britain and France over in India. And he called for neutrality, and that continued until we did break free from Britain in 1921. And that was sort of the mentality of our neutrality at the time. We'll do the exact opposite of whatever England's doing. So our neutrality might have been born out of not wanting to do what they did. However, it's developed over the years, and in fact, it's a point of pride to Irish people that we're neutral and that we understand the violence and that we know that we have a place in the world and that we can help with reconciliations. There's a lot of people who have experience in this type of stuff now in Ireland. And neutrality really is it's a real source of pride for a lot of Irish people. In all of the polls that are ever done, it comes in at about 80% of the Irish public wants to be neutral and does not want to be involved in foreign conquest or foreign entanglement.
And do they mean by that that there should not be U.S. troops going through Shannon Airport?
Oh, absolutely, yes.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Even the most recent poll last year, I think, came in at 70% said Shannon Airport should not be used by not just U.S., but the U.S. is the primary user. But some NATO nations also use Shannon Airport, but, you know, it's 98% American flights, 2% NATO.
Yeah. It seems like there are nations that are supposedly neutral, like Sweden, for example, that go even farther and allow NATO war rehearsal exercises and so forth. And there are others like Switzerland that you hear about all the time as being famously and I, as far as I know, actually neutral. Is there any legal understanding or practical alliance among neutral nations? How do you enforce neutrality?
There is indeed, yes. In fact, I had a conference in Ireland this year where the theme of the day was looking at the rule of law and legalities with regards to Ireland and its neutrality, the European Union, the Kellogg-Briand Pact, and a variety of other things. And one of the speakers of the day, Karen Devine, who is a lecturer in Dublin City University, gave a very detailed presentation on the European Union and the militaristic overtones of its constitution, or some of the clauses within it. I can read you here just from, this is from 1992, and this is about the question of neutrality. And a quote here now, it says, "The question of neutrality and compatibility with common foreign and security policy is, however, a particular concern." And it goes on to say, let me see here. It goes on to say that neutrality is not compatible with the European Union. And slowly and surely, as the Lisbon Treaty had was to enable true we had a referendum for that in Ireland, to which we said no. And Europe was shocked and our government was embarrassed because they had both the big parties in Ireland had both been campaigning yes vote. And the public said no, so we did it again, we said no again, and they repackaged it again a third time and we said yes the third time. And this ties us into a mutual defence clause, a solidarity clause. So if one of the other European nations is attacked, we are obliged to collective defence and to stand by our co-members of the European Union. So the reality is neutrality is actually dead and buried. Especially since we signed PESCO, signed up to PESCO this year. That's the Permanent Structured Cooperation. It says nothing about military. It says nothing about an army, but that's it's a standing army for Europe. We have signed up to that, and we will be sending troops to that army. I'm afraid Ireland and its neutrality it has been whittled away bit by bit over the last number of decades, the last four decades or so.
It seems the president of France, when the president of the United States was there on Armistice Day, was talking about a European military that could stand up to not just Russia, but the United States. Is there a possibility, for better or worse, I'm not sure which it would be on balance, of this European militarism actually working against the Irish permission for the United States to use its airports?
I don't know exactly how this will work out. It certainly looks like there will be a European army. Who they'll work with or against would remain to be seen. I personally would be for a restructuring of global politics, but not retreating into the violence. Like the United Nations, I'd prefer to rest on law. I think the United Nations does need to be reformed. Like, it's very undemocratic. Like China, which would have well over a billion people, or India less, but again, around a billion people. They would only get one vote each with the United Nations, the same as Andorra and Liechtenstein. So in theory, those two little countries can outvote China, which is doesn't take into account the demographic of the planet, and it leads to instability because you have countries who aren't getting the say that they should.
It seems that regardless of which way the European Union goes, it's going to be possible for the people of Ireland, if they get organized enough and active enough, and if the rest of the world helps, to break off the military relationship with the United States, and even break off the military relationship with NATO and the European Union.
That's a very pertinent question, David. The French president, as you say, has called for the European army, so even more militarism in the world. Like, from my point of view, understanding that, you know, violence is only tit for tat, there is no way that's a positive move. That can only lead to more violence. From my point of view, less is the only way forward. I'd be a believer in closing foreign bases, and one step along the way, that'll be a long process, but one step along the way could be transforming bases from attack-orientated bases with long-range missiles and weapons of that nature to defensive weapons. You know, so like America has 50 military bases in Italy. If all of the weapons in those bases were reduced to defensive weapons, short-range weapons, so that they could only defend Italy, like they say that's what they're there for, that would be a positive step, as opposed to being offensive bases who could start a war in Libya, like they just did. They have bases in Sicily. They were used for Libya. So President Macron asking for the development of a European army, which isn't new news, but it's now the curtain has been pulled back. It's crazy talk, and it can only lead us to dark, dark places. And in fact, on that point, like in Ireland, as I said at the start, Shannon Airport, a civilian airport, is used by the American military and NATO military, but 95% the American military. That's a civilian airport. It's not an actual base. That should be a base. It's a de facto base. It should be. We should be able to stop access to that civilian airport by the use of militaries, whether it be American or any other. And in fact, we have, as you know yourself, a petition going with World Beyond War. It's to get the US military out of Shannon Airport, which already has almost 10,000 signatures. Which we're still gathering, and it would be great if people are interested if they went to our website. That's worldbeyondwar.org/Ireland, and that'll bring you to the petition to stop the use of Shannon Airport for military purposes. And there was also the recent conference in Dublin on the weekend of the 16th, 17th of November. The first international conference on the closure of bases, where there were representatives from all over the world, from America, from Japan, from all over Europe. It was very successful. And so there is a lot of movement by people to move forward with this and to try and demilitarize the world. And if people are interested in getting involved, not just no bases, but in anti-war, pro-peace type of activities. You know, everybody has different capabilities, everybody has different restrictions, time availabilities, energy, you know. So, like, if people are interested in doing this, some people can't do any more than be an armchair activist. And that's fine, you know. People can donate. We ourselves have lots of peace merchandise, T-shirts and cups and telephone covers, which, if people have no time and all, but they'd like to contribute in some way, that's a nice, easy way for them to do it. Again, they can go to worldbeyondwar.org and just do a quick search for. In fact, it's on the homepage, the merchandise for sale. Or maybe like the homepage on Facebook and do some social media sharing, whether it be Twitter, whether it be on Facebook. Or if people have a few hours to give, they might consider contacting the group that suits them best for the thing they're most interested in. Maybe it's the movement against nuclear weapons. Maybe it's ours, where we have a nice, clear objective. It's the abolition of all wars. So people should inform themselves a little bit and think what they have to offer and see where they can fit in. There are positive developments in Ireland at the moment. There has been a recently formed government group that's dealing with neutrality and disarmament. That has 50 current politicians in Ireland are in that group. That's about a third of the Irish government. The Irish government has, I think it's 153 politicians. So quite a sizable chunk of the current Irish politicians have formed their own group to not deal with, but to investigate the question of our neutrality and our complicity in foreign wars and everything that's going on in the world at the moment. There are many conferences go on in Ireland. Last week in Galway, Luke Min Flanagan, who is a current member of European Parliament, held a conference in Galway City, I believe, looking at Irish neutrality. Then there was the No Basis conference in Dublin. Earlier this year, I organised the conference in Clochjordan, where we looked at the rule of law, its actual uses, its potential uses, Ireland's militaristic neutrality, friendly neutrality, all the very in detail. We had a great look at law. Last year, I organised a different conference where we looked at the shared edge between war and ecological destruction. I will be organising another one for next year. It'll be in Clochjordan again. The theme hasn't been decided yet, but if people go to Facebook and go to World Beyond War Irish Chapter, they can stay up to date and be informed on things that are happening. Thank you very much, David, for asking me on today. It was really a pleasure, and I hope that your listeners got something from our conversation.
This is Talk Nation Radio. I'm David Swanson. Take action at rootsaction.org. Help end war at worldbeyondwar.org. All past shows can be heard at davidswanson.org. Talk Nation Radio is produced in Charlottesville, Virginia, and syndicated by Pacifica Network. If you are listening to a nonprofit station, please support that station. Talk Nation Radio is funded by contributors at davidswanson.org. There is no way to peace. Peace is the way. Until next time.
To Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Counterspin.
Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines. I'm Janine Jackson. This week on Counterspin, we recently marked 22 years since the passage of the Personal Responsibility and Work Opportunity Reconciliation Act, which Bill Clinton proudly declared would fulfill his campaign promise to end welfare as we have come to know it. Corporate media did little to undercut the idea that poor single mothers were bleeding the country dry and making it harder for them and their children to access benefits would somehow be healthy for them and the economy. What you might not remember is that not everyone was on board this particular train. Many people questioned the racist, anti-woman, and anti-poor mythologizing at its core. And those folks had and have their eye on a different world in which welfare policy actually is anti-poverty policy and is part of a humane social and economic program that connects health care and housing and income and well-being. If we want it, we have to talk about it, and that's what our guest is doing. Felicia Kornbluh teaches history and gender studies at the University of Vermont, and she's co-author with Gwendolyn Mink of the new book, Ensuring Poverty, Welfare Reform in Feminist Perspective. We'll talk with Felicia Kornbluh this week on Counterspin. That's coming up, but first we'll take a quick look back at some recent press. In a November 11th piece headlined Deadly Gaza Raid by Israel Threatens Nascent Ceasefire, the New York Times described an Israeli assault near the city of Khan Yunis that killed seven Palestinians as, quote, the first known Israeli ground incursion into Gaza since Operation Protective Edge in July 2014 set off a seven-week war, close quote. As John McCullough wrote for Fair.org, this depiction of the attack as a unique occurrence in recent times is wildly inaccurate. Since the 2014 Gaza War, the IDF has carried out 262 ground incursions into the Gaza Strip, according to the UN Office for Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs. 70 of these have occurred in the past year alone. Such incursions are indeed a regular occurrence, but they are rarely reported by media or known to the general public. An article by Henriette Chakar in 972 magazine, which was reposted by Jim Loeb's Loeb blog, quotes a retired Israeli general, quote, activities that most civilians aren't aware of happen all the time, every night and in every region, close quote. Operations by the Israeli military can have a devastating effect on ordinary Palestinians in Gaza. Combined with the ever-changing buffer zone declared by the IDF, they make it hard for farmers to grow crops or raise livestock, worsening the area's already tenuous economic situation. Errors like the New York Times's minimize the degree to which Israel continues to occupy Gaza, despite claiming to have disengaged in 2005. And they aid a media narrative in which the IDF is reacting defensively rather than acting as an aggressor. Fair encourages listeners to communicate with the Times and ask them to issue a correction on the frequency of IDF ground incursions into Gaza. You can write to NYTnews at nytimes.com, remembering that respectful communication is the most effective. And finally, as you see stories about the frenzy over post-Thanksgiving shopping, you might remember something David Carr wrote in the New York Times 10 years ago. Carr, who passed away in 2015, was writing in November 2008 about a round of news reports finger-wagging over the death by trampling of a worker at a Walmart store in Long Island. Coverage, Carr wrote, suggested that the worker's death was, quote, a symbol of a broken culture of consumerism in which people would do anything for a bargain, close quote. But in the search for the usual suspects and parceling of blame, he said the news media should include themselves. Because, quote, just a few days ago, the same newspaper writers and television anchors who are now wearily shaking their heads at the collective bankruptcy of our mass consumer culture were cheering all of it on, close quote. Carr cited a story in the Atlanta Journal-Constitution advising readers to leave the children at home, at least the ones not big enough to carry the loot. Younger children may pitch a tantrum that slows your progress. A McClatchy Tribune wire piece claimed, "Nothing rivals the thrill of waking up before the sun or that sprint through the store for the perfect present." And while Newsday, Long Island's Daily, wrung its hands on the opinion page about whether this deadly rush to lower prices is an illustration of the current economic malaise, before calling the trampling death another stain on the too often sordid image of our island, in the run-up to it, the paper was offering a Black Friday blueprint with store openings listed so shoppers could plot strategy. Well, is this pointing a finger at harmlessly light coverage? Carr says no, because the coverage is not so much trite as deeply cynical, an attempt to indoctrinate consumers into believing that they are what they buy and that they should be serious enough about it to leave the family at home. And he added, quote, "Media and retail outfits are economic peas in a pod. Part of the reason that the Thanksgiving newspaper and local morning television show are stuffed with soft features about shopping frenzies is that they are stuffed in return with ads from retailers. Yes, Black Friday is a big day for retailers. Stores did as much as 13% of their holiday business this last weekend, but it is also a huge day for newspapers and television. In partnership with retail advertising clients, the news media have worked steadily and systematically to turn Black Friday into a broad cultural event." Close quote. Just a reminder that what you see in the news is not always there for strictly journalistic reasons in this or any season. You're listening to Counterspin, brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group Fair. The policies and practices known as welfare reform, marked by Bill Clinton's 1996 signing of the Personal Responsibility and Work Opportunity Reconciliation Act, always traded on a number of myths, often abetted by the media. Myths about how much money the government or taxpayers spent on aid to families with dependent children and on what those families receiving assistance looked like. And the myth that the receipt of state support discouraged people from working, creating what was bemoaned as a culture of dependency that might affect two or three generations. But at the center of the myths around welfare and the need for its reform were always women, and particularly Black women. Shouldn't they work more? How many children should they have? How is their working or not working affecting Black men and the perennially troubled and troubling Black family? For a policy that always claims to be about economics, welfare policy has always been about much more. Recognizing and understanding that can be part of a necessary reboot, as my next guest describes it, of the policy conversation around poverty. Felicia Kornbluh is Associate Professor of History and Gender, Sexuality, and Women's Studies at the University of Vermont. Her books include The Battle for Welfare Rights, Politics and Poverty in Modern America, and she is co-author with Gwendolyn Mink of the new book, Ensuring Poverty, Welfare Reform in Feminist Perspective. She joins us now by phone from Vermont. Welcome back to Counterspin, Felicia Kornbluh.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, we remember 1996 and the fight around welfare reform. We used to put reform in quotes then. Media depictions of support recipients as lazy, as having children to avoid work. Diane Sawyer got in a young mother's face to say, "Why should I pay for your mistake?" But what was debate is now backdrop, you could almost say. The PRA, the Personal Responsibility Act, passed. People were cut from the welfare rolls, and Democrats and Republicans toasted their bipartisan triumph. Corporate media essentially chided critics of the policy. See, the sky didn't fall. So place us in 2018 and the point of intervention of this new book. I mean, some of those premises seem kind of entrenched now.
Well, yes, and I appreciate your reminding us of all of that, because the first purpose of the book is precisely to remind people of the fact that this wasn't always so. And it's not just that the policy wasn't always so, but the debate wasn't always so. It didn't always have the same form. And we didn't always treat it as just common sense that, you know, of course the government would not help people in times of desperate need, that, of course, mothers of young children were expected to be in the labor market full-time or more than full-time, that the government sort of had a hands-off attitude toward people who may have, you know, committed quote-unquote mistakes, may have been partners with abusive men, or may have had a child with somebody who was later incarcerated. There was a time when there was actually very broad agreement on the fact that the government had a role to play in people's lives. And so I think it's worth it for us to go back and unearth that if we want to make some kind of new direction, if we want to have some kind of new approach to the relationship between government and all of our families, if we want to have a more honest and robust conversation that goes beyond the Me Too glamour and actually talks about the status of all women in America, whether they're in the labor market or not in the labor market. So that's the first thing that we want to do, is unearth the history of this so that we can remember that what's taken as obvious today isn't obvious, and it wasn't obvious, and there was enormous contention. And I think that is a critical point of intervention with the media, because it's the mainstream of the Democratic Party and it's the mainstream media working together that keeps saying, you know, this was a success and this is obvious and there was consensus in the 90s. There was no consensus, and the policy has not been a success. It's been the opposite.
Well, we watched it in real time, a kind of bait and switch in the so-called liberal press. I remember papers like the New York Times starting out saying, well, we'll agree to, it would be okay to cut benefits as long as there's a guaranteed job. And then the job went into parentheses, and then it became, well, a job or else some training or else, and then it just kind of disappeared, you know, and
right.
Childcare.
Incredible credulity or something worse.
Exactly. Childcare went the same way. So it folks may not remember that it was sold as an anti-poverty program, and now it's being celebrated as simply being anti-welfare, and the difference between those is what's being elided.
Yes, I almost hesitate to say this because, of course, Donald Trump is horrible, and right. Our contemporary politics are terrifying. But it's worth remembering also that, you know, Bill Clinton was a pretty good liar, too.
Yep.
Donald Trump is a liar, but, you know, Clinton was also a liar. And he said all the time, and people in his administration said all the time, or suggested at least, that there was going to be child care available for every person who was now going to be expected to be in the waged labor market. You know, that people weren't just going to be thrown off the welfare rolls willy-nilly, but that there would be, you know, he kept on saying there would be opportunity, there would be education, there would be training, there would be jobs, there would be child care. But none of that was actually in the law. Our book actually starts, the first chapter is just a reading of the actual federal law. And we did that because we just want to get clear on what it is that we're talking about here. You know, and there's been so much misrepresentation. There was then, and there continues to be so much misrepresentation. And yeah, so childcare was never really given to people. There was certainly no entitlement to childcare. There was more money overall, but not enough. Education, access to education and training was cut dramatically. Actually, right before this welfare reform, people who were receiving assistance and raising kids, they had access to pretty good educational support. People were getting community college degrees. The community colleges actually were developing pretty good programs. And some people got four-year degrees or even master's degrees while they were receiving some assistance and raising young children. And that did allow them to make a different kind of a life for themselves, to get away from abusive partners, etc. But what happened after the Bill Clinton and Republican Congress created this law is that things just went in the opposite direction, and it was just a story of compulsion and driving people away, and ultimately of getting people to not even ask, you know, to not even apply for the benefit.
Right. Right.
And I think that was the real purpose of the law.
Well, so much of the mid-90s conversation was really about poor women. You know, we used to hear about welfare policy in a context of social engineering about women, you know, people essentially worrying that women who can survive without men, not to put too fine a point on it, that women who are able to survive economically without men will do so, and that that means the apocalypse. You know, welfare was family discouraging, and Black men in particular, you know, go to the bad if they can't be heads of families, you know, and now we're back in Moynihan. You know, I understand you're sort of saying that that awareness has drained a bit from the discourse, that understanding of how much it really is about women.
Yeah, there's a funny thing that's happened in public discourse in mainstream media and also in mainstream political conversation, that there is a lot of talk about sex and gender and even about sexuality and transgender, and that's all wonderful. But when we talk about people who are economically strapped and we talk about anti-poverty policies, somehow that whole dimension of the conversation has dropped out. So the policies are still targeting folks on the basis of gender, the so-called deadbeat dads on the one hand and the so-called immoral moms on the other hand. Like, they're still getting the short end of the stick, but we don't think about those issues in gendered terms. Mainstream media people who write about this stuff and mainstream political people, they have another file that they put all these issues in and that they sort of relegated these people to. And that is another purpose of our book, is to bring the gender lens that in some ways we're good, at least in our academic lives and our intellectual lives, at applying to our society, and actually take them and look at what's going on in the anti-poverty realm. And when you do that, it just seems outrageous, you know, the kinds of stereotypes and myths that are directed at especially low-income men of color and low-income women of color are just nutty and incredibly destructive.
Well, the book, I see it as also wanting to relocate this welfare conversation in a broader context, not just the conversation, pardon me, but the policy itself within the context of a broader understanding of social net programs. And it has to do with really a very colorful and vivid and various idea of what life could be like, you know, if people didn't have to struggle. So it really is about revisiting radically, in the sense to the root, you know, anti-poverty programs, of which welfare policy should be seen as a part.
Yes, absolutely. And there are some really obvious links between this story and things that are very hot today. Like, for example, the continuing push by the Trump administration and some state administrations like Kentucky to impose work requirements on people who get their health care through Medicaid. And I think if you're not a policy maven, that you might think that sounds reasonable. You know, sure, everybody should work. We all have a responsibility to work. But if you understand this history and you understand the real racial and gendered stereotypes that are inevitably attached to that whole conversation, then you might get to be a little more suspicious. Like, when you understand that what happened when quote-unquote welfare reform occurred in the 90s and when there were work requirements applied was that people were just impoverished and they were pushed off and the government got to save a little bit of money and, you know, and our good data indicate that people died.
Right.
You know, we have good, solid data that indicate that death rates for people who would otherwise have been recipients of this aid went up, right? That's what's going to happen with Medicaid work requirements, too. This is not about, you know, putting our healthcare system in dialogue with the labor market and helping people get out of poverty. This is about systematically impoverishing people and perhaps killing them. That's really what the policy is. And I think it sounds good to some people in part because those racial and gendered stereotypes are still just woven right in there. The idea, you know, why do you have to have a work requirement? Because the assumption is poor people, non-white people, et cetera, are not working. And that's just not true. It's just, you know, it's an utter myth. Black women work harder than any other group in our society. And this is consistently true. You just have to look at the damn numbers. And, you know, a lot of people in mainstream politics are just not interested in doing that.
Well, and those same myths that media failed to really dig out from the root up of the idea of people who receive assistance not working, for example, when we know that many people work more than one job and still require, you know, something else in order to be able to pay the bills. And I guess what I wanted to also talk about is, and that the book is about as well, is that progressives and Democrats have to show a vision and have a vision, you know, that a different world is possible, not just that this one sucks, you know. And I know that Democrats are going to argue until the end of recorded time about whether Trump won because people feel economically dead-ended or because people are racist and misogynist. But doing the work of growing a broad safety net income policy that advances justice and economic security, as the book talks about, that would seem to me to really give us work to go forward with.
Yes, I hope that the document that we include in our book at the end, which comes from the early 2000s group of advocates that my co-author and I were both part of, I hope that that can provide something of a launching point. And also just remembering the amount of debate and remembering that there were progressive Democrats and independents like Bernie Sanders, who was at the time in the House of Representatives and then later went to the Senate. You know, there were folks who were offering an alternative vision, not just saying no,
right,
but also saying, look, our families are struggling. We need a public policy that supports families. Their argument was, and my argument would be, those folks were just asking the wrong question, you know, talking about this one tiny corner of the government, which has always been stereotyped or has long been stereotyped on racial and gendered grounds, instead of looking at, you know, what kind of society do we want to have? What kind of economy do we want to have? Why do families have to work so damn hard? Why can't parents be with their kids? Why are people giving up their kids to foster care and adoption? Why are so many people in jail? You know, like, what are we doing here? What are, you know, what's this social engine that's just creating misery and stress and shortening our lifespans? Like, that's the real pay dirt, I think. And if we can start from this story and sort of go out from there and look at the questions that weren't asked in the 90s and that have been driven out of debate by mainstream politics and the mainstream media, then maybe we can start to recover the real questions.
You spoke of it as almost the kind of original sin of modern politics to have, in welfare reform, almost sort of sold off a part of the constituency and said, you know, we will disassociate ourselves with these folks and somehow that will save the party. And that when I last spoke with you in 2015, you were saying, on terms of welfare policy in particular, we have to do both. We have to fight back against the predations, the new things that come up. Okay, a means testing for immigrants. Okay, you know, a work requirement here. But also have a whole entirely new alternative that we can put forward. And you actually mentioned like a truth and reconciliation process where we figure out why we took this wrong turn in terms of what we believe about people who need help, which is basically all of us at some point.
Yeah, I had a hope, which has been partially realized. When I started working on this project, I had a hope that sometime in the 2016 Democratic primaries, there would be a real reckoning with what that party had become in the 1990s. And it was very interesting to see that, in part, that happened.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, there has been a lot of energy on the progressive left that's centered on the Sanders campaign. But what didn't happen is we didn't talk about it in terms of women and gender. And we did not talk very much about poverty, and especially women's and children's poverty. So I think, and now I think a lot of people have been kind of thrown into a defensive posture because the threats are so real to the things that we care about from the Trump administration. But I think that, that's actually a good sign overall. I kind of wanted Hillary Clinton to apologize. Like, that was my secret desire in starting to do this research, that at some point Hillary Clinton, Bill Clinton would say, you know what, we were wrong. This was a Faustian bargain, and it was terrible, and we co-signed a lot of stuff that we shouldn't have co-signed about race and gender, and we want to do better. So, okay, that didn't happen. But I think there's a lot of energy on the left and even in the Democratic Party to rethink some of the wrong turns that were taken in the 90s. And I want this book to be a part of that and to be informing that process.
We've been speaking with Felicia Kornbluh, Associate Professor of History and Gender, Sexuality, and Women's Studies at the University of Vermont. Her new book, with Gwendolyn Mink, is called Ensuring Poverty, Welfare Reform in Feminist Perspective, and it's out now from University of Pennsylvania Press. Thank you so much, Felicia Kornbluh, for joining us this week on Counterspin.
Thank you.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by FAIR, the National Media Watch Group based in New York. If you missed part of today's show or you'd like to hear previous shows, you can find them on FAIR's website, fair.org. The show's engineered by Alex Noyes. I'm Janine Jackson. Thanks for listening to Counterspin.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Radio Eco Shop.
This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
The savage wildfires in California became a national tragedy this week and a global worry. It is still early days, but we have the potential for hundreds dead in these strange November megafires. They struck after a long-standing drought, pumped up by climate change, withered the vegetation, and killed 129 million trees in the state. We will start this show with an interview that is so different from anything else you've heard from any other media reports. On the ground from Northern California, literally choking on smoke, I talk with radio host Mariah Gallardon. Meteorologist Jason Salmonow from The Washington Post also joins us. We will touch on possible radiation released in a fire that burned over a nuclear lab site 30 miles from Los Angeles. You know, the place where America's worst nuclear accident happened, and they never told you. I've checked with the L.A. branch of Physicians for Social Responsibility, and I will play a short clip from Libby Halevi's show, Nuclear Hot Seat, and Arne Gunderson. This fire reporting is stirring up my own unresolved angst about fires near my home in British Columbia, Canada, over the past three summers. Like when I went out on the porch this year and saw a fire coming unannounced over the crest of a hill right opposite us. That makes a man feel nervous. I almost wept on hearing the situation in California. Tens of thousands of people are temporarily homeless. They're struggling. It sounds like several thousand of them will remain homeless, a new burden for California. Any facilities in nearby Oroville and Chico, California, have been overflowing. Those who made it out by car are living in their cars, whole families. They are the lucky ones. Others are in tents or under tarpaulins. Mariah tells us that the city of Paradise, population around 27,000, was a poor community. Few bought or could afford fire insurance. And even the lucky few that had it, the insurance would not be enough to rebuild. And that is because these city fires erupt with so many toxic chemicals from our burning homes and cars. When fire torched homes in the Redwood Valley last year, people returning were required to clean up the soil around the homes, some going 2 feet deep over the whole lot. Once it burns, a neighborhood begins to sound like a Superfund site. That is the toxic way we live now. Lurking behind all these fires, unseasonably late, driven by hot Santa Ana winds, moving faster than cars at times, is the big one, climate change. I don't need to phone up more scientists to get the facts. Back in 2013, I posted my first show with an expert. It was called The Age of Superfires. 2 years later, in 2015, I collected three fire science interviews that I'd done for a new program. And since then, I've interviewed at least a dozen fire experts and climate scientists from all over the world. It adds up. And for Western North America, and apparently now for Scandinavia and Russia and Australia, superfires are the new normal. Perhaps megafires seem distant to you. Maybe you've been flooded out and loaded with snow already. But we know the smoke will travel thousands of miles, that a lot of people will be damaged not just with their property, but their minds and their hearts have been hurt. A new wave of carbon has been released from the trees to the sky, and that may affect climate change. And the world's fifth largest economy has been rocked by a fearful new reality. Earth has become an unstable and more risky place to live. That is where we have come, in our gas cars and our oil machines and our coal power. Climate change has arrived. It has many frightening faces, and one is fire. From Mendocino County, here's my talk with Mariah Gallardon, recorded November 14th, 2018. We have reached longtime radio producer Mariah Gallardon in Northern California. She's the host of TUC Radio. Time of Useful Consciousness has been on the air for a very long time. It originates in San Francisco, and it is syndicated to other stations. Over the years, we have played several of Mariah's pieces on Radio EcoShock. Hello, Mariah. How is it going where you are?
Hi, Alex. It's smoky here, as you might have guessed.
Yeah. So in a quick email exchange, you talked about being worried of toxins in the fire smoke that's even getting indoors right into your living room. What are you concerned about?
The most recent fire, the tragic fire that's still going on, that burned down a whole town, the whole town of Paradise, 100 miles north from here, where over 7,000 homes went up in flames and many cars. That's been by far the most toxic-looking fire. As you may know, we had two of the biggest fires in the last 2 years right outside my door, the Redwood Valley fire in October 2017 and the Mendocino Complex fire that began in July 2018. And those fires were mostly vegetation fires. So when we did fire watch here from our high point on the ranch, we would sit there and see the white plumes of smoke coming up beyond the next ridge line. And every now and then the plume turned black. And we know now from experience that's when a home went up in flames, or a vehicle. And this particular cloud coming down from Paradise that lasted for a week, that was black from the very beginning. You probably all have seen the photos of it.
They're terrible photos. I've collected a few because I never thought I'd see something like that. And as you say, modern homes are filled with chemicals and heavy metals and the building materials and the cars and the electronics and the paints. And now all we see at Paradise is a dust pile, really, punctuated with twisted steel and bits of concrete. What had to happen in Redwood Valley before they could rebuild there?
In Redwood Valley, to my surprise, no house was allowed to be rebuilt unless it was investigated for toxins, and in some cases, like 1 to 2 feet layers of the dirt around the house and in the perimeter foundation, if it wasn't a cement slab, had to be removed. And when I was surprised to see the list of toxins that they were looking for, people said to me, well, your house is made of straw and clay, so that's not very toxic. But what about your solar system? What about your batteries? What about the lead in your batteries? So I am not really living a toxin-free environment either. And I also have to have actually two cars to get in and out of here. One car that's a four-wheel drive that gets me through my 3 miles of dirt road when it's raining or when there are landslides, and a smaller car that I use when I have to go to San Francisco. So cars are amazingly toxic themselves. You look at the photos from Paradise more closely, you see these wrecked cars and you see huge frozen puddles of aluminum, as it turns out, when the motor block melted.
It's astounding stuff. And then, Mariah, when we lose a home, maybe we can rebuild, but when a whole community is wiped out like Paradise was, it's hard to imagine. Can it ever be the same?
No. Many of these people don't even know how to rebuild because Paradise was a low-income community and hardly anybody had fire insurance. And the whole infrastructure burned up, too. This is actually a new problem. We are hearing from the adjacent cities of Oroville and Chico that they are now facing having to absorb the population. That's 27,000 residents that are now homeless.
Wow.
And they're currently, there are not even enough shelters for everybody, so there are tent cities going up on parking lots to serve as temporary shelter. And those who were lucky enough to escape in their cars For instance, a friend of mine who used to work for a local radio station here, she almost didn't make it out in her car. She had about 5 minutes when she realized the world was burning around her to just throw a few things into her car, including her guitar. They're often so moving items people pick up. And I've done that too a couple of times. I was evacuated. Later I thought, why did I pick that? So she got into a huge line of vehicles trying to escape that was in an enormous traffic jam. So the sheriff came by and said, you're faster on foot. And she, in spite of flames now licking at the road from both sides, got out of the car and started walking. And then all of a sudden it started moving again, so she rushed back to her car and was the third to last vehicle that escaped. Some people have their cars to live in, but that's about all.
We've had this locally in the city of Grand Forks, which is the next town to me. They had a levee break in the floods this summer, and there was flooding. A whole part of the community was wiped out. The provincial, or what you would call state government, promised a lot of money and aid. We've got your backs, the premier said when he came to visit, but in fact, nothing has really come through. We've got people who are living in RVs that they try and put skirting around the tires or something, but they're not winterized at all, and the homeless situation is terrible. It's really developed that way. But you've raised another problem, and that is whether to get out in your car. And strangely, after the Black Saturday bushfires, I want to tell you a story. In 2009, the Australian government changed their position on staying to fight fires. So many Australians died in their cars trying to get out. And so the government suggested, well, maybe you could stay if that's what you want to do. And there was a similar situation in 2017 in Portugal. 62 people died in their cars fleeing a fire. It's really confusing, Mariah. I mean, personally, if fires come to my place, I'm going to try and get out quick. We have documents and bug-out bags, and we've got bins to load some crap on a pickup truck if we have to. I don't know. What's your plan?
You are totally right about that. A car can save you, and a car can be your trap. And I observed that, too. My personal plan is I'm looking at a mowed area that once a year when the wildflowers are done blooming, I have it mowed with a tractor. And I can't tell you the size of it, but it takes this tractor about an hour to mow the area. And it's fairly well maintained because it's being mowed at the beginning of the summer when nothing grows anymore. And that's my fire safe zone. I offered it to neighbors too to come into. We had a helicopter land on it on one occasion because it's very mountainous, the terrain here. So this is a rare flat spot. And my plan was beginning in 2008, actually, when I first had to fight the first fire here. My plan is to bring two cars into the center of the fire safe zone, loaded with water, and then stay there and defend my house. Because many, many times the spotting and wind throw of embers and little branches could have been prevented from turning into fire if somebody had been there, even just with a bucket and a burlap bag and maybe an Indian pump sprayer or a backpack sprayer. I heard many examples of people who have done that and saved the house, even in paradise. Can you imagine that inferno? Couple of people stayed and had little 5-gallon buckets and put out flames around the house. So that's the plan. But I took note of those changes in policy in Australia, too, because in the 2008 lightning fire here, we were told by the fire department in no uncertain terms that if we were asked to evacuate, we had to leave because we were endangering others by staying. Because I don't know if the policy is the same in Canada, but fire department has to save lives first and then property. Although the way they array themselves, you often think that's maybe not always true, because property, of course, is of high value in this society. But we were told, if you do this, you endanger others. So it's a real dilemma. And the only reason this real dilemma was broken in a way was the 2008 fires that were my first fires. And they were called the lightning complex fires because they were set by a flurry of lightning that occurred in the middle of the night, woke me up. I saw the trees around me illuminated by this flash, bright blue light. And these lightning fires set over 100 fires here in Mendocino alone. So the fire department had more than they could handle. And eventually they brought in troops from all over the western states. These fires went on for a month. So what we had to do here, we had to do our own firefighting. We could see where the lightning has struck. We went up there with trucks, with containers of water, like 300-gallon containers. Some people on the ranch here had little Honda pumps. And we joined the overall effort of creating fire lines. We helped the bulldozers. We put out fires that were smoldering. You probably have seen that, too. The tree looks as if it's out, but then you realize it's hollow in the inside and it's a little smoke rising from it.
Right, or the roots are on fire.
Yes, yes. We fought fires here for 4 weeks as amateurs. We learned a lot.
And, you know, another problem that we're going to see more and more with climate change is evacuation fatigue. I read that the town of Paradise was given 4 evacuation orders in the last 10 years, so some people just don't believe in it. The same thing when a hurricane strikes, you know, you get the hurricane warning and then, it moved away from the coast, it wasn't so bad. So the next time they get the warning to evacuate and they stay and some lose their lives because of that. So that evacuation fatigue is another problem that we're going to have to face.
You know what my experience is, you really have to keep the preparation and the organizing up. Maybe in 2008, people wouldn't believe that it would get worse. But by now, pretty much everybody around me, including Trump supporters, they shake their heads when he says, climate change is a joke, because they see it in their cattle, they see it in their agriculture, they see it in their vineyards. They experience it, and that experience is much more important than any Fox News pronouncements. So everybody is aware of this becoming worse and worse. And in addition to that, you know, if you're counting the size and seriousness of the fires, just here for my community in Mendocino County, we had the worst in terms of size and the worst in terms of destruction directly affect us here. So people are organizing to do things because neighbors can help neighbors. In many cases, that's the only thing that will help you, because it happens too fast or it happens on such a large scale that the people who are professionally obligated to deal with it just can't handle it.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I am Alex Smith, here with California radio host Mariah Gallardon of TUC Radio at tucradio.org. Mariah, the stock price crash for California electricity provider PG&E. That follows reports that problems from their power lines may have started at least one of these deadly mega fires. Have you heard anything about that?
Yes, I have. And I just reissued a program I recorded in 96, and the person I interviewed then was naming automobiles and power lines as the two main ignition sources to worry about in the forest restoration project he was working on in Mountain Grove. And there were more examples of high power lines igniting it's maybe too early to call the Paradise campfire for that, but there was a fire under transmission lines. And PG&E is sort of arguing, well, we don't really know if we started the fire or if the fire started the breakdown of our transmission line. But I saw photos of that initial blast that the Paradise, Town of Paradise Fire Department tried to deal with. And it was strangely stretched long, as if something happened along between two pylons along the transmission line. Actually, maybe I shouldn't be saying this. I'm speculating. But I should talk about the Redwood Valley fire that started last year in October 2017. And that was clearly laid to PG&E, as well as the fires that started around Santa Rosa around the same time. And, you know, you can just look into the CAL FIRE or whoever is your local fire agency, and they list the sources. So they often say power lines. They say power lines, automobiles. They say lightning, which surprised me when I looked it up, that lightning still causes about 50% of the fires, but not necessarily the ones that were most severe. There's only one home that burned in the 129 fires that were caused by lightning in 2008. And, you know, Native Americans dealt with lightning fires with ease, and they had no helicopters or fire bombers or fire departments. Those fires usually are relatively mild when they start. They hit a tree, and you can rush and extinguish it before it spreads with minimal technology.
You just produced an updated version of your mini-documentary about Native American forest practices. Tell us about that, and can we learn a lot from the original inhabitants of the West?
Yes, that was, I think we can. And when I first produced it in 96, I was hoping people were to look at the Western forests, the California West forests, and see what was once there and how it could be gotten back. The forests that the settlers found in the early 1800s, or the Spanish conquistadors or church people who came up from Mexico, were extraordinarily open. They had about 15 trees per acre in the Mountain Grove area, where Dennis was counting trees, and now there are a few thousand per acre. They had these beautiful, big, old-growth trees that were not considered a lumber source. They were considered a food source or just a home. And the openness of those forests made the conquistadors say, this is like a park. We can ride our horses right through here, not knowing that their hoofs were treading on carefully tended root gardens that they didn't recognize because there weren't any fences around them. But the Native American forestry here was highly involved in the well-being of the forest. Dennis Martinez was crediting Native American women for setting these small burns. That was the technology they were using. Small, soft burns that hardly ever got out of hand, that were burning for the acorn crops to keep the acorn trees healthy because that was food. They were burning for the basket plants because those were the cooking and storage implements that were needed, and not just even one, like willow or hazelnut. If you look at the Native American baskets from this area, there were dozens and dozens of sources of brush and bush that were used in those baskets. And the landscape was gently modified to produce home and shelter. So now, if the women who did this burning up to the mid-1800s, when it was outlawed by settlers and led to the totally overgrown, junky forests we have now, they wouldn't recognize the forests they want. And the reason I put this program back out was to give some inspiration to people who who realize that bringing back fire is actually a wise idea, but they don't always do it the right way. I mean, there was just a controlled burn 2 weeks ago, 16 miles north from here, that got out of hand in spite of fire department standing by. I don't know what they did. I mean, they run around with these little flamethrowers to get things going.
I've been following a guy, he's a professor, David Swain, I think his name is. He's in Weather West is his Twitter handle. And he's been putting up maps about how the fire season has been growing longer and longer, and basically said that if the rains that normally, in quotation marks, came in November had arrived before these recent fires, they probably wouldn't have happened, or certainly wouldn't have happened to the horrific extent that they did, and that the plants were just so dried out that they're all tinder. And then we add into that people building their homes in canyons with just one road in or out, and a lot of population expansion in California. It seems like a bad mix with climate change and more people in that beautiful state.
That's true. We had one rain so far. We often get some rain in this area in October. There's nothing in the forecast. We had half an inch, and we're hoping for more rain between November and March, but it's not sure that's going to happen in any large quantity.
Right. How long has TUC Radio been on the air?
Almost a quarter century.
And just for people who don't know, what can people expect to find on your show?
No, recently I have done more climate change, although I never miss any of your shows. I find that the service you render is really extraordinary, but it's sort of a civic responsibility to cover it, especially since hardly anybody else does. Although it's kind of curious, California is different in some ways. There's actually a state office that's OEHHA. It's the Office of Environmental Health and Hazard Assessment. And they have a very interesting, wide-ranging climate change assessment page. And if you're asking yourself, why is it so dry? Why is it so windy? Why are the rains coming so late? Why are the rivers and lakes so warm here? Why are the coastal waters so warm as well? How is acidity rising in those? That's actually all kept track of. Also, the famous snowpack in the Sierra Nevada, that's what's being measured by this office. And you see a picture for the last, especially the last few years, of conditions that are rising that enable fire, dryness, trees dying from the heat. We had 129 million fir trees die in California between 2012 and 2017. And those are standing dead for the most part, an inviting source for fires.
We have the same situation in British Columbia. The pine beetle killed off whole valleys of pine trees, and they were turning red for a while, and now they're gray, and they're standing firewood. The government invited logging companies to come in and take as much as they could while it could still be run through mills. They probably took a quarter of a half of a percent of what's out there. And so we're looking at a couple of decades of super fires here. And so I really feel for the people of California. I know what people there are going through. And from Northern California, within smoke distance of the campfire and the former town of Paradise, we've been speaking with radio host Mariah Gallardon. Thank you, Mariah, and I hope to talk to you again, hopefully, in better times.
Thank you, Alex.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
Welcome back to a Radio EcoShock special on the great fires of California in November 2018. After his career at the EPA, meteorologist Jason Samina leads the Capital Weather Gang at the Washington Post. He is one of the most influential climate-aware weather journalists, in my opinion, in the United States. Jason, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks so much for having me.
Do you think the recent fires in California will be seen as a turning point for the state or for the country?
I hope so. And, you know, I hope that, you know, all of these extreme weather events that we're having or extreme natural disasters, which have climate change linkages, are a wake-up call so that our nation will take climate change more seriously and think about how we can manage the risks and respond appropriately.
Can you give us an example of how climate change could be involved?
Absolutely. So, you know, in the case of the California fires, both the Woolsey fire and, of course, the Camp fire, which has been so devastating, they were both spurred by unusually warm and unusually dry conditions in California. This has been one of the driest falls on record in California, and the last 5 years in California have been the five warmest years on record. And so when you have these tinderbox conditions, when the vegetation is dried out, it just sets the stage for wildfire disasters, because when you have strong winds, you know, coming down these mountain slopes, raging at 50, 60 miles per hour, if you get a spark and the conditions are so hot and so dry, it's just an explosive situation for these fires to consume thousands of acres in a matter of hours.
Yeah, I was listening to a talk by Park Williams. He's a bioclimatologist at Lamont Doherty Earth Observatory, and he says plants are releasing water faster in a warming world, and that must contribute to how dry those plants are.
Yeah, absolutely. What happens is that when you warm up the atmosphere, it increases something called evapotranspiration. So basically, the water which is stored in plants goes from the plants back into the atmosphere. And so the plants dry out and they basically become kindling. They become fuel for these fires. And the fires just eat this stuff up and burn very rapidly when you have so much dry vegetation.
So those Santa Ana winds can whip wildfires into firestorms. Can you explain how those work?
Sure. So typically what happens is when you have an area of high pressure set up around Utah, Nevada, the clockwise winds flow around high pressure. And so when you get these winds coming from the east toward the west over these north to south oriented mountain ranges in California, the air is forced down the mountain slopes. And when the air comes down the mountain slopes, it accelerates and it also dries out the air. So what happens is relative humidities drop precipitously. So you get these relative humidity values in the single percentages, you know, 8-10%, so that the air becomes very dry. You've got this hot wind coming down. So if you have any sort of fire igniting under those circumstances, it becomes an explosive situation. And that's what we saw with the Camp fire, where, you know, things developed so quickly. Emergency managers, they couldn't do anything. All they could do was try to protect people. They couldn't even worry about battling the fires. They just had to try to move people out of the way. And in some cases, because of the gridlock on the roads, people couldn't get out of the way because the fire was moving so fast, and that contributed to the loss of life.
And as you reported in the Washington Post in 2017, the U.S. Department of Agriculture announced a record 129 million trees died as a result of the drought in California. Do scientists think that's a one-time loss, or is it part of a longer pattern under climate change?
Well, what we've seen is we have seen a trend towards drier conditions in California, especially during the fall. There's a lot of variability in precipitation year to year. And so, you know, and drought's part of the historical record in California. They get drought. They've seen droughts on and off for decades. But what we're concerned about is that precipitation is becoming a little bit more extreme. In other words, when you get droughts, they're tending to last longer, become a little bit more intense. And then on the flip side, when we have heavy precipitation events, when those cycle through, those tend to be heavier as well. So we're seeing a trend towards more extremes. And that's consistent with a warming climate, because when it's warmer, it speeds up evaporation. So when you're in a dry situation, the land surface dries out faster. But when you have storms coming in, there's more water vapor in the atmosphere for the storms to draw from, and so you get heavier rainfall.
Yeah, Daniel Swain said that if the atmospheric river that often hits California in November had come just a couple of weeks earlier, we might not have seen these terrible fires.
That's exactly right, and atmospheric rivers are one of the primary sources for wintertime precipitation in California, and they're instrumental, you know, in terms of the rainfall that California needs for, you know, for its water supply. If and when they get delayed, that can have important consequences for drought, for wildfires, and if we're seeing trends toward drier falls in these atmospheric rivers, these storms that hit the West Coast come later, that extends the wildfire season. And in fact, Swain has documented that the wildfire season's starting earlier and ending later. So we're basically expanding the duration of the wildfire season. So it's almost year-round now. We've seen wildfires blowing up almost every month of the year.
Have we seen, Jason, a switch towards El Nino, and is that a factor?
Yeah, I mean, that could potentially be some good news. So whenever you have El Nino, it does on average, and not every case is the same, but on average, it does tend to increase precipitation in California, and we saw that a couple of years ago. So hopefully El Nino will materialize, and that will bring more rainfall this winter, so things won't be quite as dry when the next dry season comes along next summer, and we won't see a repeat of these devastating fires. So we've got to hope that the rain delivers this winter and that El Nino does what it does on average. But again, every El Nino event is different. Some deliver more, some deliver less.
And as a meteorologist, you helped build that bridge between weather reporting and climate change. Do you think we're getting to the point where global warming is destabilizing the weather?
Yes, I think it's part and parcel of what we're seeing with the weather right now. If you warm up the atmosphere due to climate change, it affects weather events. And so you see more extremes in heat, you see less extremes in cold, you increase the intensity of precipitation. And so we're seeing that in the statistics now, too, in terms of the number of record highs we're setting, many more record highs than record lows. We're seeing the percentage of the heaviest precipitation events increase. So I think you have to connect the dots, and you're also seeing it with hurricanes too in terms of the amount of rainfall they're generating. If we look at like Hurricane Harvey, for example, or Hurricane Florence, those produced record amounts of rain, and there have been attribution studies which have looked back at those events and found that due to climate change, the rainfall from those events increased substantially, as much as 30-40% in some cases. So yeah, I think you absolutely have to look at the weather in a climate context, because we're not dealing with a stable climate. We're dealing with a climate that's changing, and so that necessarily will affect weather statistics and the intensity of weather events, and you can't divorce the two. They're connected.
Something that puzzles me is, why do you and Chris Mooney and the other staff at the Washington Post get to report fully on climate change when the rest of the media sees it as a side story or just doesn't talk about it at all?
You know, I think it depends on the media organization you're talking about. What we do at the Post, and I think what most responsible journalists do, is they try to mirror the findings of the scientific community. And so because the scientific community has found that climate change is affecting the weather, we report on it. And I think there are, you know, the Associated Press, you know, Seth Borenstein does a great job connecting the dots there and reporting on weather and climate and the connections. And the New York Times has a very formidable climate desk and a team of journalists there that do great work. You've got people at Mashable, at Vox, at Grist, at Slate. I mean, these are all fairly prominent news organizations, some which are more digital, some which are more historical print organizations, which are covering climate, I think, in a robust way. On the other hand, yeah, I mean, there are certainly the opportunities that are missed. Some television networks don't connect the dots as much as maybe is warranted. And so there's definitely room for improvement there. I don't disagree with that.
We have stolen a few minutes from one of America's busiest weather desks. Jason Salmanow is the weather editor for The Washington Post. Thank you so much for sharing your time with us, Jason.
You bet. I enjoyed it.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. Once again, in the recent California superfire, there was a collision between the nuclear threat and climate change. California's wildfires burned over the once secret Santa Susana Field Laboratory, formerly owned by Rocketdyne. That was the site of a partial nuclear meltdown in 1959, kept secret for 20 years, and still little known to the public. You can see a half-hour documentary about the accident on YouTube titled LA's Secret Meltdown. I'll put a link in my blog. The site is in the hills between San Fernando Valley and Simi Valley, about 30 miles from downtown LA. A top-secret sodium reactor went into meltdown in 1959, releasing radioactivity hundreds of times greater than the 1979 Three Mile Island meltdown in Pennsylvania. There was no containment to protect Simi Valley or L.A., and that is long-lived radioactivity. Immediately after the recent fire roared through the site, the State Department of Toxic Substance Control claimed no buildings were burned there and there was no danger to the public. But as you'll hear, some of the infrastructure was burned. And the group Physicians for Social Responsibility asked how the DTSC could know that, considering no samples were taken or tested before they made this release. Nobody can see radiation visibly. There were about 10 other experimental reactors at that site, and former Atomics International employees recall nuclear materials and radioactive equipment scattered around with illegal open burn pits. That was all supposed to be cleaned up by 2017, but of course, it was never done. When I last spoke with Denise Duffield from the Los Angeles chapter of Physicians for Social Responsibility this week, she was trying to organize an effort by citizens to collect soil samples to find out the truth. We'll hear more about that in a minute. The original reactor meltdown was kept secret for 20 years and only discovered by accident by university students working under Professor Daniel Hirsch. Dan now heads the community monitoring group for the Santa Susana Field Lab, called Committee to Bridge the Gap. And let's face it, nobody trusts the official agencies to tell us the truth after decades of lying about it. The unstoppable Libby Halevy put out an immediate program on this nuclear risk, renewed in the recent Woolsey fire in California. Her show is Nuclear Hot Seat, and this nuclear fire special has interviews with Denise Duffield, Arnie Gunderson, and Maggie Gunderson from Fairwinds Energy Education, plus other local activist guests. Here is how Libby starts the show.
The Woolsey fire in the Los Angeles area is a terrifying event, still critically dangerous. As a fire, it's bad enough. But then you learn that it started at the site of a 1959 nuclear meltdown in an uncontained building, meaning that deadly radiation was released into the air and contaminated the land where it has remained on this Superfund site. And then you hear someone who lives near the site and has for all of her life and has been dealing with the consequences of this accident for years tells you.
Once we found out that it was burning at the field lab, we had news footage showing flyovers by helicopters with a rocket stand on fire. And that's when I realized this is our worst nightmare realized. This couldn't be any worse. There's no situation worse to get the contamination to the people than by a fire.
Well, when you hear that from someone who has lived with the Santa Susana Field Lab nuclear nightmare for years, that's when you learn that you and everyone around you is inextricably stuck in that seat. Yeah, that one. The seat we all share.
Nuclear Hot Seat.
You can get that nuclear fire special from nuclearhotseat.com.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
Let's think for a minute about what this fire means to the overall economy. As you heard from Mariah, there is plenty of talk about equipment from California power companies starting these latest fires, the most deadly in the state's history. There are signs that the campfire in Northern California, where the town of Paradise burned, began at a utility power line. CNN reports, quote, PG&E disclosed in a regulatory filing earlier this week that it experienced an outage on a transmission line just 15 minutes before the campfire broke out, end quote. The New York Times reported, California utility customers may be on the hook for billions in wildfire damage. In Northern Cal, Pacific Gas and Electric Company, PG&E, could go bankrupt. The lawsuits for damages could be billions of dollars more than the company's insurance. We learn from Libby Halevy that at 2:22 p.m. on Thursday, November the 8th, just 2 minutes before the Woolsey fire was spotted at the Santa Susana nuclear site, The Chatsworth substation, owned by Southern California Edison, also had a power outage incident. California Edison and PG&E were already saved once by legislation signed by Governor Jerry Brown this September. That law let the utilities pass fire damages on to customers, and it was put in place to prop up the state electric grid after more than $10 billion in damages from the previous record fires in 2017. The new law did not cover 2018 damages, which are expected to go way over the previous $10 billion. Just imagine all those multi-million dollar mansions that burned in the canyons, the schools and hospitals burned out, roads melted, hundreds of thousands of people evacuated, a whole town burned over, possibly with hundreds dead. These fires of November 2018 are going to open up a whole new chapter of costs at a time when the state and federal debt is already into the trillions and individuals are also highly in debt. That could be, in my opinion, the start of a slow climate-driven collapse. Eventually, in some soon coming year, we will be unable to pay to rebuild, to repair, to recover. Then whole cities slip away and stumble, and we still have unheard-of staggering costs to transition our society away from fossil fuels as we try to save whatever is left. For now, the state of California has hinted they will bail out the two major utility companies again, just as Japan had to bail out the bankrupt Tokyo Electric Power Company after the nuclear disaster at Fukushima in 2011. That is just the power companies. Countless thousands of Californians are now homeless, and only some of them will struggle back into housing. The social bill to support fire victims will be huge. Companies have been hard hit. At this time, some do not know where their employees and customers are. Some will require cleanup of toxic properties before they can start up. Others have no buildings or truck fleets left. Farms, including giant farms that partly feed the nation, were blackened. Orchards and timber were lost. The list is long. Of course, nobody will try to count the loss of the wild spaces and the things that live there, or the gorgeous spiritual places that are now barren black spots. Fire is cruel. Now look, I've lived in California. There are amazing people there, and the landscape is still inspiring, and it will continue to be a strong place. But we are in the beginning stages of what could be a ramp down, and certainly will be very difficult times as climate change unfolds in its fullness. Now it is time to enter the radio time warp. The next 5 minutes is from my 2013 show, The Age of Superfires. Are we entering the age of super forest fires? Our guest is John Betts, Executive Director of the Western Silvicultural Contractors Association. He's in British Columbia, Canada, in the gorgeous lakeside town of Nelson, B.C. John, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks, Alex.
Is there a potential for super fires?
Yeah, I think there is a potential. And to kind of answer your question, not to shorten the interview by any regards, but I think we've already entered the era of super fires, both in Canada, continental U.S., Australia, and other areas as well.
Well, why do you say that?
Well, what we're beginning to see are fires of unusual intensity, severity, frequency, and so on, occurring in different forest types across the world. Again, I'm most familiar with what's occurring here in B.C. and in parts of the U.S., but certainly we're seeing the same tendency in Australia. The other thing that adds more severity to these and sort of brings with it a whiff of catastrophe is the fact that human habitat has been encroaching into these forest ecosystems, which are in a certain, we'll talk about a little later, but they're in a not a great state to begin with. And once you begin to embed human habitat like homes and so forth, as well as infrastructure like watersheds and transmission corridors, quite a lot of values are at stake. And so we're seeing loss of infrastructure and lives as well. And communities are being destroyed by wildfire on a scale we haven't seen before either.
Well, so what is new about these fires? We've had fire for centuries. What's new about these?
Well, I referred to intensity and severity. So those are, I don't want to dwell too much on the technicalities of it, but the intensity refers to the energy a fire releases, and severity is the duration, to put it simply, the damage it does in the duration of time it spends burning. What we're seeing, because of the available fuels, and this is a term I'm going to come back to this, because there's so much more wood on the landscape to burn, we're seeing fires burn, as I said, with more energetically, with longer durations, with increasing frequency, and also spreading at quite higher rates than we've typically seen. So fire behavior in many locales around the planet is changed significantly. Plus, these fires are beginning to take on a capacity to be destructive, not only to the communities that we have built in them, but they actually are starting to damage the ecosystems that they are part of themselves. They're actually doing long-term damage to the habitat. These fires are burning well out of the sort of normal range of variability that we might see.
Right. You told Justine Hunter of the Globe and Mail newspaper these fires can burn so hot they actually sterilize the ground. Does that mean nothing much grows back there for a while, or not a forest, or what?
The fuel is across a large portion of the landscape here and in many other parts of continental U.S. and other parts. The fuel is now structured to burn quite differently than it would normal if it was a normal standing forest. So, and when that happens, the fires burn for a long time, and the heat is radiated down into the soil, and it's in that soil that all the little enzymes, bacteria, seeds, and so forth that under a normal healthy fire regime would simply resprout and come back actually get killed off. We're straying into some unknown territory here, but the balance of probability is in favor of anyone that wants to say we're going to, as I have been saying, see increasingly large fires, increasingly frequent fires, increasingly intense and severe, and the catastrophic outcomes will be felt in many areas, economically, socially, and so forth, and they will be enduring. This is one of our largest challenges I think we face. This is a challenge of such complexity on such a scale that some of the old positions and the old thinking really isn't a match for it. And we're going to have to find new ways of approaching these problems.
We have been talking with John Betts, Executive Director of the Western Silvicultural Contractors Association in British Columbia, Canada. That was Radio EcoShock reporting on the new age of superfires in 2013. Now we go to 2015. Now we hear a bit on climate drivers of superfires from Dr. Mark Cochran, climate scientist and an expert on wildfires and global climate change. He's from the South Dakota State University. This recording comes from a teleconference held by Climate Nexus and broadcast on Radio EcoShock September 2nd, 2015.
They're not changing so much the number of fires as the ability to control these fires. So many of these fires are getting larger every year and impacting more areas. And the way this is primarily working is that with climate change, we have rising temperatures. And when we look across the we've looked across the planet, but the West has large areas that are seeing very significant rises in temperature. This helps increase the fire danger together with relative humidity, drought in general, and wind speed. And the West in particular has kind of the worst combination going for it in that we have significant rises in temperature. We have significant drops in relative humidity that dries out fuels. We have increases in the number of rain-free days. So even if the amount of rain is the same, the number of days where we have no rain is increasing. And then not so much on average, but from year to year, we have a higher frequency of high wind years. So when we have high wind, this is when we can actually make what would be, you know, a significant fire into a very large fire. So things like the Okanagan Complex in Washington State right now. So we've looked at that, for example, over the last 35 years, and that's what we see for the West. And this is part of what's driving the growing severity of these fire seasons. Also, as we look forward in time, the chances of this continuing are very high, where we're going to see a lot of increases in the temperature. Greater than 70% of summers are expected to be exceeding the highest temperatures on record for the Western U.S. by mid-century, for example, if we continue with our current emissions path. One of the biggest problems for the West, though, is the snow accumulation, which is very important in the montane regions. And they've been getting warmer and will continue to be warmer, so much more of the precipitation will be as rain instead of snow. So greater than 80% of years are are expected to have March snow amounts that are less than what would be median values today, and greater than 60% would have March snow amounts that are below the minimum late 20th century amounts. So very, very dry. So this will lead to very dry summers in general. And the high temperatures of the summers are likely to be much higher, potentially up to 5 degrees C higher by the end of the century. So an exacerbation of many things would stress to the trees from these events. So they will have significant die-offs of trees in general from drought. And also this opens up for insects and bug kill as well. So we have a combination of factors that will tend to exacerbate the wildfire situation in the West in coming years.
That was Mark Cochran from South Dakota State University. And next we hear from the firefighters. Retired Captain Lou Paulson was the president of the California Professional Firefighters. This is from the same Radio EcoShock show in 2015, originally recorded by Climate Nexus. Incredibly, the situation Paulson describes 3 years ago could be right on the news today.
I don't need to tell you folks that, you know, the state's on fire, the West is on fire, and I think let me just put it into perspective from a emergency response view and how we are looking at this in California. And to the credit of Governor Schwarzenegger, he established Blue Ribbon Fire Commission to look at the problems when we had the fires, big fires in San Diego a number of years ago. And Governor Brown is continuing that with the Climate Change Task Force, and we're tackling these issues, realizing that they are not situational to a drought, but more of a trend of the future. And because of that, I think from the fire service perspective, we are changing how we look at wildland firefighting. It's now not uncommon. And in fact, I would tell you, every firefighter in the state of California, whether you're working on an engine company in downtown San Francisco or Los Angeles, or you're working in the foothills of California or in the hills of California, everybody's being trained on how to be a wildland firefighter and what those hazards are, because we do know that these events are not around just the jurisdiction where they happen, that the resources that are needed are going to be a multi-level government. It's very common now to have local government strike teams and firefighters on U.S. Forest, National Park property fighting wildland fires, because we do not have the resources. Government does not have the resources at any level to really head this climate change, this wildland fire problem off. And so it's going to take a combined effort. What that ultimately means for various levels of government is that local government becomes more and more stressed, because the fact that while you're sending extra units out to maybe 5, 6, 8, 10, 12 hours from where the jurisdiction is, emergencies are still happening. And it's unfortunately not uncommon that you may send the 5 engine companies out of your own department to a fire in Northern California at the same time you have a wildland fire breakout in your own jurisdiction. So we're seeing more stress and strain on the emergency response system, mutual aid system in California, which is undoubtedly is the best mutual aid system in the world. It's having a lot of problems trying to fill capacity and get resources. And as you've seen in an example in Washington, they're asking for firefighters outside the United States to come in. We've had firefighters outside California come in the fires already this year, and normally the peak wildland season for California starts in September and runs through early November, although recently that's even become longer and more year-round. So I think from our perspective, we are seeing just more of a fire problem, more of a erratic fire problem. In simple terms, to give you some perspective, when we talk about high winds that happen, those high winds, problem it creates is that it preheats fuel and increases fire spread. So you have spotting in front of the main body of the fire. Those fire conditions become more erratic because conifers and heavier fuels are usually, in a non-drought situation, are more able to sustain a fire. When they're weakened by drought, they become part of the fuel complex and part of the fuel problem. So we as firefighters see the fuel problem expanding exponentially and becoming more and more of a year-round problem than a seasonal problem. So that's a perspective, at least from the firefighters' outlook on climate change.
That was Lou Paulson, president of the California Professional Firefighters in 2015, describing the situation in California at that time.
Radio EcoShock.
That's it for Radio EcoShock this week. Let us remember those who lost so much in California in November 2018. You can find more links and info in my weekly show blog for each program at ecoshock.org. Thank you so much for listening to Radio EcoShock and caring about our world.
Today we're going to talk about what's going on in Haiti, because nobody else is. We're not being told about this in the mainstream media here that I'm aware of, but there are huge demonstrations that have happened. There have been people killed by the police in various centers. It's a nationwide. There are nationwide demonstrations. We're going to talk to Jean Saint-Ville, an activist in Ottawa who's Haitian, been there recently. It keeps in close contact there, and we'll try to give you some sites. One of them is Haitian Info Project. If you just write Haitian Info Project, that should come up. And they're doing, in my view, great work of keeping the world informed. And, of course, we're in this magic period where basically they put up the pictures so that you can see the demonstrations. People, you know, record these things on their phones, upload it or download it or shoot it to the others, and you can pick it up in a matter of hours. It's wonderful work because they're conflicting the mainstream story to the extent that it is being followed, is being downplayed. We'll get into that with Jean Saint-Ville. And then we're going to talk to Christopher Black. And Christopher Black is a well-known international lawyer. He writes on the matters to do with particularly struggles of people, populations against imperialism and for independence. he has defended, accused at the international criminal tribunals of both Yugoslavia and Rwanda. Those were what they called ad hoc, which is embarrassing to say that there is such a thing as ad hoc tribunals. It's kind of a road show. But Chris distinguished himself in trying to establish the truth. So we'll be talking to him because he is going to be a speaker, Phil, at a Peace Congress.
What is that? The Canadian Peace Congress Convention this weekend, November 24th, 25th. $10. There you go, for a two-day session. Saturday the 24th at 25 Cecil Street, the Steelworkers Hall, 9 o'clock in the morning till 4. And Sunday at the GCDO Hall, 290 Danforth Avenue, 9:30 in the morning. And, yes, Chris Black is one of the featured speakers.
And Eva Bartlett.
Eva Bartlett is going to be there. So those are the two highlights.
All right, read us the names again.
Okay. Canadian Peace Congress, November 24th and 25th, general admission, $10. All sessions open to the public. Saturday the 24th at 9 a.m. until 4 at the Steelworkers Hall, 25 Cecil Street, addressing the growing war danger. Sunday the 25th, 9:30 a.m., the GCDO Hall at 290 Danforth Avenue, Building the Peace Conference, plenary session, adoption of a peace program for Canada elections and special resolutions. And Christopher Black, Eva Bartlett, Tamara Lojinks, and Grand Chief Stuart Phillips, an Okanagan Aboriginal leader and the Grand Chief of the Union of BC Indian Chiefs.
There's two more there.
I'm giving you some of the names, and that's
– Okay.
Yeah, okay.
So that's going to be this weekend.
That's this weekend.
Well, it's timely, I got to say.
Peace, yes. Peace is timely and not much talked about.
Not at all, actually. And the timing couldn't be better. And I think we have Chris Black on the line. Are you there, Chris?
Yes. Hi, Phil. How are you doing?
Good. Well, thanks an awful lot. We were just noting here, you're speaking this weekend at the Canadian Peace Congress. Of course, we want to know what your themes are going to be. I could point out we're seeing this trip around Asia, the Vice President Pence has gone out of his way to insult China directly. By the way, he initiated that. The way the Globe is reporting, it was he's had words with the leader of China, but actually right. Pence is the aggressor. Yeah. And then he went out of his way put on a glaring face because apparently at the sidelines of this meeting he met Putin. I hate to say it, but ordinary people, they do tend to go by, are they getting along or not getting along? It doesn't look like they're getting along. So what would be the theme you intend to strike in your remarks?
Well, as I said in my email, I'm still formulating what I can say because I only have a small amount of time, and there's mm-hmm. many things to be said, but I guess I'm going to say that the three things. First, the use of what they call the responsibility to protect or the new white man's burden mm-hmm. to justify all their actions. All their actions are based on somebody's being bad and we got to beat them up or stop them from doing what's bad. Mm-hmm. It's our burden to do that. We're the civilized. We're going to deal with the barbarous, uncivilized peoples we need to dominate.
Mm-hmm.
So that has to be... There's a lot of people actually think there is a responsibility to protect. That has a legal doctrine, and it isn't. It's totally bogus and fake. And all these humanitarian interventionists who rely on this doctrine are relying on, actually, illegality. The second thing would be the use of sanctions, or what they call sanctions, really economic warfare,
mm-hmm.
As a form of warfare, really, to pressure countries to do their bidding or their obey their will. And the third would be, I guess, nuclear disarmament. That without nuclear disarmament, we can't have a chance of getting peace because if uh-huh. powerful nations have powerful weapons, they have no need to seek peaceful resolution of their issues with other nations.
Mm-hmm.
So, and then finally, I guess maybe that we can't really have a peaceful world unless there's some balance of power in the world. Where there's mm-hmm. real equality of nations, where there's no nations able to push other ones around.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a matter of power politics, I suppose.
Yeah. We're speaking to Christopher Black. He's going to be at the Canadian Peace Congress, and that is going to be November 24 and 25. And all sessions are open to the public, and that's going to be at the Steelworkers Hall on November the 24th. By the way, do you know are you speaking on 24th, 25th,
We're all speaking on the 24th. Uh-huh. I think Eva Bartlett's going to be there and Miguel Figueroa or some other people.
Mm-hmm.
I'll be speaking in, I think, around 1:15 p.m.
Uh-huh.
But we only have, I think, 10 to 15 minutes to speak each because we have limited time at the hall.
Uh-huh.
And the next day is a series of sessions about organizing the anti-war uh-huh. movement, the peace movement.
And that's going
Canadian yeah. Peace Congress can take a role in that.
Yeah, that's beginning at 9:30, and that's going to be at 290
right.
Danforth Avenue, building the Peace Congress and plenary sessions. And, mm-hmm. they're going to adopt a peace program. I hope, by the way, they include your elements. I think the one you listed, you and I have, of course, worked together on this with Charles Roach, Ramsey Clark, and mm-hmm. others. This has really been an insidious, dirty device,
yeah.
this so-called responsibility to protect. And it's really bizarre that Canada involves itself as though it's a player. We all understand
right.
that the lift, as General Dallaire liked to call it, the lift and the power has to come from Washington, basically, and NATO. So Canada says, we think we should go in and protect, and then people say yes, and then the U.S. Air Force and U.S. Navy show up.
Right, and there's a conference, I think, in Halifax just last weekend or this week. I can't remember which. It's so the blurbs for it, and I went on the website, the Halifax conference, where Canada is hosting an international meeting of NATO, basically, mm-hmm. but including their corporate sponsors like Boeing and Raytheon, people like that. And so we have our Canadian defense minister sitting there, hosting these American corporations and all these American officers and all the other NATO hacks,
mm-hmm.
justifying their planned aggressions against China and Russia and Syria and everybody else.
Yeah. Well, I guess
it's disgusting and shameful that Canada, which claims to be an upholder of international law, is one of the prime movers, prime Yeah, MOVE is in helping the United States disobey or break international law.
I always think of that title, Peacemaker or Powder Monkey, the answer being Powder Monkey.
A book
about Canadian foreign policy.
Basically, where you're using Canadian taxpayers are paying money to the government to use our Canadian armed forces as auxiliary forces to the imperial American forces.
Yeah.
For American interests, not for Canadian interests.
Yeah. And it's turned into such weird window dressing. They said in order to show that we're ready to play some kind of new role, they went to Mali. They're already talking about leaving Mali, and literally nothing changed except that they came and left.
Yeah.
And Mali's a mess.
Yes. And, and the whole thing going on with France and Russia in, I think, Mali now as well. There's a lot of things going on with the government in Mali about why Canada may be leaving. But you're right. Canada goes off tooting its horn everywhere and gets involved in many places, Ukraine and Haiti. But the results are always negative.
Yeah. By the way, we're going to be – I don't know if you've been following, but later in the show, we're going to talk to Jean Saint-Ville about Haiti. Right now, I mean, Canada played a very heavy part in the removal of Aristide.
Yes.
And that place has been a nightmare. And now they're not reporting it, but apparently the widespread demonstrations and riots, as they use that word, in Haiti.
Right. And, yeah, Canada had our J2F2 special forces were used to help the American Marines put a gun to Aristide's head and Shanghai him or kidnap him and take him to Africa.
Yeah.
And we did that in the promotion of – I don't know what how they justified that. Well, they tried to keep that secret, but
yeah. Well, that's
what Canada does.
That comes under R2P. Now, Chris, on this matter, what about – here's another issue the Canadians, I would think, should be addressing. The U.S. is tearing up treaties right and left. So-called international norms, to quote Lavrov, are just ignored.
Right.
The nuclear bill, you mentioned nuclear. Now, think about it. You must be thinking about the consequences of this idea, the intermediate range agreement. The U.S. says, well, we're going to just get rid of that? So bad things happen, right?
Right. And I think it's clear why they want to do it. I mean, their new the new strategy for 2018, the military strategy, says that they have a nuclear first strike policy and that they have the right to use nuclear weapons on the battlefield anytime they feel like it. Anytime they determine it's necessary, they are going to use them.
And they are the only power that says that, right?
I mean, they are the only one that says that,
yeah.
Which makes everybody else nervous and on the hair trigger, China and Russia especially.
Yeah.
But by leaving that treaty, the Russians and the Chinese, of course, are very anxious that the result of that is that they're going to place their nuclear-tipped cruise missiles inside Poland and Lithuania and Latvia and everywhere else close to the Russian borders, which so they have less time to intercept them.
Mm-hmm.
That's the purpose of it. And they can do that immediately.
Yes.
They can do that tomorrow if they haven't already done it. So that's just an excuse to further pressure Russia and put it under threat.
Yeah. And again, a symptom we're seeing is that the UN went through its list of resolutions, as they often do at the General Assembly, and Russia put the resolution saying that there should be no promotion, a glorification of Nazism, that should be – all countries should condemn it. And the United States and Ukraine voted against that. By the way, everybody else, as far as I know, everybody else voted for that. Maybe Canada abstained. I don't know. I don't know if they didn't.
Yeah.
I missed the meeting. But my understanding is that it was basically the U.S. and Ukraine.
Yeah, because Ukraine has quite distinct outright Nazi elements within its government. And it's these armed militias it tolerates and funds, apart from its own regular army, which are used to attack the Donbass republics and frighten people within Ukraine proper.
Mm-hmm.
Right. So, they're in violation of the law and also the Nuremberg principles and everything since World War II. They're actually promoting Nazis in governments, which is to their benefit.
You, of course, your last point on what should be done, and you'll be advocating at this meeting of the Against Imperialism, Militarism, and War, the Canadian Peace Congress Convention, at Saturday, November 24, 9 a.m. to 4 p.m., Steelworkers Hall, 25 Cecil Street. disarmament. Now, by the way, this matter came up, and again, Canada has begun to waver or act strange. Wasn't it about a year ago at the UN where there was a resolution about, you know, working towards nuclear disarmament, and some countries initiated it. And Canada's position was, we're not in favor of that because we are under the U.S. nuclear umbrella.
Right. I think it's got to do with the treaty against nuclear weapons, or to ban nuclear weapons outright, which many nations have sponsored and signed on to, but all the nuclear powers have said have not. Mm-hmm. Although North Korea, the DPRK, was the sole exception, was the sole nuclear power to vote for the resolution for this treaty. And as we've seen, North Korea is the only nation which has said, if we can have peace, we're willing to disarm tomorrow.
Yeah.
But they're not allowed any peace, so they don't. And then they're blamed for it.
Yes.
And sanctioned because of it.
Yes. And,
but, yeah.
You know, I'm really glad you pointed that out. By the way, my memory is that they actually did some strange maneuver at the UN that caused those who wanted to discuss the matter to meet outside UN property.
There's some game going on.
It's a muscle job they pulled. And, lastly, you raised the matter of North Korea. By the way, you have visited North Korea. You've actually been there. Very few people in your shoes can actually say that they've done it, seen it. They're making today's Globe and Mail and other papers think it's very horrendous development that the president of China says that he's thinking of going to visit North Korea.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Well, they are neighbors. I mean, you've been in a region. I think they have a border.
Very close relationship, yes. And when I was there, there were lots of Chinese tourists in North Korea, lots. Well, so it was a constant flow back and forth across the border. And also we saw people from the south, by the way. But they're outraged that somebody's going to speak to the North Koreans, even though the South Korean government seems to be, President Moon seems to be quite progressive on this and is trying to establish peace with North Korea on his own terms and trying to evade the United States somehow, which the United States doesn't like.
Yeah.
So there's a very strange thing. It's actually something very interesting going on between the two regions of Korea, North and South, to unite the country once again somehow. I think.
Well, yes, when you were there, there was a complete hostility and the daily propaganda broadcast and noise and military exercises. And actually, I think we've finally gone maybe 12 months without this heavy U.S. Exercise, which is involved flying directly toward the North Korean border at low altitudes with planes that might or might not have nuclear weapons.
Right.
I mean, that's off the table. But I guess they're worried they thought they operate like a monopoly, that if Trump meets what's his name? I can't say his name.
Kim Jong-un.
Kim Jong-un. Yeah. I keep wanting to say his father's name.
Kim Jong-un.
So then it's supposed to be he joins us. He has to be part of our monopoly. He shouldn't talk to China anymore.
If he's,
you know, the President of the United States can visit him, but it'd be bad for the President of China to visit him.
Yeah, they feel that you can see the United States is starting to lose control. They're used to controlling almost everything, but now they sense that you can see them that they're losing touch. Things are escaping them, their control, and makes them very anxious. And it can make them very, very angry because they can react.
And should make the rest of us a little anxious. Yeah, you don't want to see them sort of acting like Lear, where they think, "Wow, losing the narrative," as it were. I mean, that's certainly a view I would take on the Middle East, for example. They didn't get what they said they were going to get. They were going to remove the government of Syria, and all they did was crack a few teeth and bones of their own.
The same in Ukraine. They hoped that when they threw over the governor of Yushchenko, that put Poroshenko in, they hoped that they were going to take control of all of Ukraine and put their field units right up to their Russian borders and take the Russian base.
They were going to take Crimea and turn it into a U.S. naval base was the goal.
Right, but they failed. And that's they've been totally frustrated in their main objective, and that's causing them a lot of problems.
Yeah, they're like the boxer who gets hit very hard and smiles and pretends he wasn't hurt, and you realize that guy's about to drop.
Yeah, he's reeling and trying to stay on his feet.
I'm doing fine. I'm doing great. Maybe that's why they have Trump, because everything's always going great with him. Terrific, putting his thumb up. And, of course, meanwhile, he's getting battered around the ring.
That's a thought, which is quite possible that Trump is the fall guy for the
for the operation,
the weakening of the United States. They're going to blame everything on him.
Yep.
It's the same as they did with Vietnam, that they were stabbed in the back. The old World War German thing, that they were stabbed in the back. And
lack of support
at home. And
every time the reactionaries lose, they were stabbed in the back.
Right. And we had a bad president, a weak president, a stupid president, whatever you want to call him.
Exactly. Well, Chris, it's great. I'm glad you're giving this talk. I'm glad they're having this Canadian Peace Congress, and it's going to be November 24 and 25, Saturday the 24th, 9 a.m. Chris Black may be speaking. We're estimating 1:15 just for the—
Right. And Eva Bartlett, I'm not sure she's before me, maybe in the morning if people want to catch her.
Eva Bartlett, you want to catch her because she travels so much. You never know. I say, where is she? And my gosh, she's all over the kingdom come.
She's got a lot to say about Syria, but I recommend people come out. So we're trying to get something going with the peace movement in Canada. So
Peace Congress, it's going to be at Steelworkers Hall, 25 Cecil Street, and then 290 Danforth Avenue, 9:30 to 5 p.m. Chris, it's great talking to you. There's a lot of stuff to go into. You take it easy. Thank you.
All right. Take care.
Yeah.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Between the Lines.
Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Robert Nayman of the group Just Foreign Policy, who discusses how Republicans in the House blocked a vote on a resolution and U.S. support for the Saudi-led war in Yemen, the worst humanitarian crisis in the world today. Mark Jacobson, director of the Atmosphere and Energy Program at Stanford University, who describes his vision for how the U.S. and the world can achieve conversion from fossil fuels to 100% renewable energy. And Jeremy Ornstein, an activist with the Sunrise Movement, who talks about his group's recent sit-in at House Democratic Leader Nancy Pelosi's office, demanding the incoming Democratic House majority take action on climate change. But first we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
Facing a growing outcry, Bangladesh canceled the repatriation of more than 2,000 Rohingya Muslims back to Myanmar, where hundreds of thousands of Rohingya fled after Burmese soldiers burned down their villages. Although the governments of Bangladesh and Myanmar had negotiated a repatriation agreement, no Rohingya volunteered to return, fearful of rape, murder, and arson. The plan was widely condemned by the United Nations, Asian leaders, and human rights groups. Some 2,260 Rohingya refugees were put on a list for return to Myanmar without their consent. Families whose names turned up on the list fled refugee camps, and several refugees attempted suicide. Over 700,000 Rohingya fled last summer after their villages were attacked and burned to the ground by soldiers and Buddhist mobs. According to a recent United Nations report, thousands of Rohingya who remained in Myanmar were subjected to horrific conditions in detention camps surrounded by barbed wire. Al Jazeera reports that the Rohingya, who had their citizenship rights stripped in the early 1980s, are calling for international protection guarantees before any refugees return to Myanmar. The Southeast Asian nation has denied any responsibility for abuses against the mostly Muslim Rohingya minority. A group of Rohingya refugees has called on Myanmar's civilian leader, Aung San Suu Kyi, for compensation and reparations. Suu Kyi has come under intense international criticism from human rights groups, Asian leaders, and U.S. Vice President Mike Pence. Online retail giant Amazon won $5.5 billion in tax breaks and incentives at the end of its year-long search for new headquarters. In the end, Amazon decided to co-locate its new headquarters and 50,000 high-paying jobs in both Long Island City in Queens, New York, and Arlington, Virginia. The backroom deal offering large tax subsidies has led to an angry response among some political and community leaders in Long Island City, a rapidly gentrifying area across the East River from Lower Manhattan's skyscrapers. Queens political and community leaders were excluded from the negotiations led by New York Governor Andrew Cuomo and New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio. Amazon's proposed new campus along the East River would kill a plan to build 1,500 units of affordable housing on the site. In Seattle, Amazon's presence in the city has been blamed for a 40% increase in rents over the past 5 years and a steep rise in homelessness. Queens State Senator Mike Gianaris complained, "This is no way to allocate this vast amount of public dollars without local oversight or input from the community." The Queens Anti-Gentrification Project insisted Amazon's new headquarters would make rents and daily life unaffordable for most Queens residents. Louisiana farmers produce 13 million tons of sugarcane each year, generating $3 billion. It's a lucrative crop thanks to regulated production limits and tariff rate quotas that protect U.S. growers from foreign competition. As the American Sugar Cane League proudly notes, sugar has arguably been the most successful crop in Louisiana history. For years, black sugarcane farmer June Provost has complained of harassment and discriminatory lending practices that have forced many of Louisiana's black farmers into bankruptcy. In Louisiana's Iberia Parish, where Provost farmed, the number of black farmers fell by 45% between 2007 and 2012, while the number of white farmers declined by only 12%. In the early 1980s, 60 black farmers worked the land in the parish. Now, according to the Guardian newspaper, only 4 remain. In September, with the aid of noted civil rights attorney Hank Sanders, the Provost family filed a lawsuit against First Guaranty Bank for discriminatory lending practices, violating the Equal Credit Opportunity Act, the Fair Housing Act, and various state regulations. The lawsuit claims the bank required excessive collateral for loans, forcing Provost to reduce his sugarcane acreage against the advice of Louisiana State University agronomists. On September 26th, the Provosts lost their home and surrounding acreage to foreclosure. The property went to First Guaranty Bank, the sole bidder. June Provost and his wife Angie say that they'll continue to fight to prove that the sale of their home was an illegal foreclosure based on years of discriminatory lending and fraud, and that they will work to launch a class action suit on behalf of other black sugarcane farmers. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Ruth Ann Baumgartner.
As the death toll in the Saudi-led war in Yemen rises ever higher, famine has taken hold, threatening the lives of some 14 million people. Although the Yemen war has received little attention in U.S. corporate media, Washington has been actively involved in the three-year-long conflict, supplying the Saudis and United Arab Emirates with weapons, logistical and intelligence support, and until recently, provided mid-air refueling for Saudi warplanes, which have frequently targeted civilians. UN-sponsored talks to broker a ceasefire that would allow desperately needed emergency aid into the country are scheduled to take place in Stockholm in the coming weeks. With world attention now focused on the humanitarian crisis in Yemen, Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates have recently pledged $500 million in food aid to assist millions of Yemenis on the brink of starvation. After the Saudi murder of Washington Post columnist Jamal Khashoggi in Istanbul, there's been growing pressure to end the U.S. role in the Saudi-led military campaign. But when House Democrats attempted to open debate on a war powers resolution to end U.S. involvement in the Yemen war, House Republicans used a rare parliamentary maneuver to block debate. Your reporter spoke with Robert Naiman, policy director with the group Just Foreign Policy, who talks about the Republican tactic to shut down debate and a vote on U.S. support for the Saudi-led war in Yemen, the worst humanitarian crisis in the world today.
So there's a key provision of the War Powers Resolution, which, remember, the purpose was to try and Congress trying to give itself tools to reassert its Article 1 powers under the Constitution. One of the tools that they put in was to say, if the president starts a war without congressional authorization, in violation of the Constitution, then a single member of Congress can call the question by introducing a privileged resolution and force a debate and vote on the House floor. But the fine print is that unless that House shall so determine by the yeas and the nays. The trick that Paul Ryan used was the House has a powerful rules committee. In general, every bill that goes to the floor is preceded by a rule approved by the rules committee that governs how that bill should be considered. The trick that Paul Ryan used was to use the rule on a completely different bill, the Manage Our Wolves Act, which is about delisting gray wolves. In that rule, they inserted language saying HCON Res 138, CONA's Yemen War Powers Resolution, CONA massive bipartisan bill, is deprivileged. It is deprived of its guaranteed vote. That was the trick that they used. And generally, it's very hard to defeat the majority on the rule because it tends to be a party line vote. Nonetheless, we tried. And actually, we were only shy by 7 votes. 6 Democrats voted against us. 15 Democrats voted on our side. So it was actually closer than a vote on the rule would ordinarily be. But that's how Paul Ryan got around the vote, by that parliamentary trick. That's terrible and it's frustrating. But here's the silver lining. First of all, it shows that Paul Ryan was yellow to meet us in a fair fight. And that indicates that he was afraid that in a clean vote, too many Republicans would defect and vote to end the unconstitutional war. The second silver lining is that there's a companion resolution in the Senate, which is the same resolution that Bernie Sanders, Mike Lee, and Chris Murphy brought forward in March, Senate Joint Resolution 54. That was tabled in March in a vote of 55 to 44, but it was not killed. It was only tabled. And the Senate parliamentarian has ruled that Bernie can bring that back anytime he wants, and he has pledged to do so after Thanksgiving, as early as the Tuesday, November 27th, the Tuesday after Thanksgiving. We could get a vote in the Senate. You know, we don't know what's going to happen, but it seems quite plausible that we could win that vote in the Senate. That would be world historical. Nobody has ever won a vote like that in either house before, certainly not in the Senate. Senator Murphy told Defense News some weeks ago that Sanders, Lee, and Murphy would have won the vote in March if there hadn't been a sneaky deal to replace that bill with a fake certification by Pompeo instead. Secretary Pompeo is supposed to certify that Saudis are trying to reduce civilian casualties. Everybody knows that's a lie, but Pompeo certified it anyway. So that's the second silver lining. We have a vote coming up in the Senate. The procedures in the Senate are different than the House. There's no way that McConnell can block Bernie from going to the floor. The third silver lining is that Representative Khanna can reintroduce his bill anytime he wants, with a new bill number, same text, same content, new bill number. And then it was once again privileged, once again guaranteed to go to floor. Of course, Paul Ryan could do dirty tricks again. But if he tries that in the context of Senate passage, it's a very different world. Also, the context of the world has changed. There's tremendous pressure on the U.S. government and the Saudi government now, pressure on the United Nations. The British are active. Houthis have announced that they're ready for a ceasefire. Some press reports indicate that the UAE wants to end the war. Saudi government is isolated diplomatically, particularly after their murder of the Saudi American journalist Jamal Khashoggi. So we're in a different moment now. We could end this war within the next 2 weeks. And one thing that's going to be key is what Jack Reed and Sheldon Whitehouse do. They're in Rhode Island. They voted against the Sanders resolution in March. If they switch sides and vote with Sanders and Murphy, your senator in Connecticut, now, that could tip the balance towards Senate passage and ending the war.
That was Robert Naiman, policy director with the group Just Foreign Policy. Learn more about efforts to end U.S. involvement in the Yemen war by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. In a sobering report issued in October, the UN Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the world's leading climate scientists, issued a dire warning that the nations of the world have only a 10 to 12-year window to take action to limit an increase in global temperatures below 1.5 degrees centigrade. The report concludes that an increase beyond 1.5 degrees will substantially increase the likelihood of disastrous drought, wildfires, crop failures, flooding, extreme weather events, and coral reef destruction. At an early November event sponsored by the Connecticut-based group People's Action for Clean Energy, Mark Jacobson, director of the Atmosphere and Energy Program at Stanford University, addressed the challenge of climate change, outlining the ways in which the U.S. and the world can achieve conversion from fossil fuels to 100% renewable energy. Jacobson, a specialist in climate modeling and co-founder of the Solutions Project, thinks that the U.S. is now equipped with the necessary technology and economic means to stop burning fossil fuels. The only thing that's missing, he says, is the political will. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhus attended Jacobson's November 8th talk in Hartford, Connecticut, and brings us these excerpts.
So what I want to talk about today are these renewable energy plans that we've been developing over the last decade. Our first plan came out in 2009 in Scientific American on how to power the whole world with clean renewable energy, or to really see is it possible, even though we can't actually implement a global scale plan on its own because there's nobody who just controls the whole world. Since then, we've been developing individual state plans, country plans, and now city and town plans. But I just want to point out this one paper that we did in 2014, which had a lot of co-authors, including some from back east here and a lot of students. This is a plan to repower California for all purposes with just wind and water and solar. I'm happy to say that this was actually implemented into law a couple months ago with SB 100 in the electric power sector by not only the state Senate, the state assembly, and the governor signed it finally, but the governor also issued an executive order that is not binding on the next governor, it's just been elected, but really indicates what his intent is, which was to repower California for all purposes with clean renewable energy. And it effectively goes to 100% renewables by 2045 with 60% by 2030. More recently, we've noticed just in this last election, there were three new governors who all have the platform of 100% renewable energy, including in Illinois, Michigan, and Colorado. And Nevada passed at least the first step of a 50% renewable portfolio standard by 2030. So there is some progress. Hawaii has a 100% clean renewable energy standard. So there have been a couple of public opinion surveys. One was last November. It was 13 countries, 26,000 people took part in the survey, including in the U.S. and Canada. But it's interesting, 82% of the people surveyed said they wanted a world with 100% renewable energy. That's not more renewable energy, that's 100%. That's 8 out of 10 people in the world, if this is statistically accurate, want 100% renewable energy, which is amazing. But what's kind of scary is only 66% of the same people believe climate change is a significant problem. The only good news about that is that you don't have to believe in climate change to believe in clean and renewable energy, which is fine. If you don't have to believe in the problem, as long as you want to solve it, that's fine. What is the reason for that? Well, 69% of the people said renewables make countries more energy independent. 73% say renewables will boost economic growth and jobs as well. So there are a variety of reasons people like renewable energy that they don't necessarily believe in that climate change is a significant problem. In the U.S., there are several resolutions pending in the House and also in the Senate. Maybe the House ones could actually be voted on now, to go to 100% renewable energy. There's a House Resolution 540 that has 60 co-sponsors that calls for the United States to support a transition to 100% clean renewable energy. There's a Senate resolution for a similar thing. There's Senate Bill 987 to transition from fossil fuels to 100% clean and renewable energy by 2050. And there are actually two House bills that are pending, H.R. 3314 and 3671, that one calls for 100% by 2050 and the other is 100% by 2035. So these are literally sitting in Congress waiting to be voted on. But actual laws that have been passed include Hawaii, a 100% renewable electricity law by 2045, California, a similar one by 2045, with 60% by 2030. Vermont, actually more aggressive, 75% renewable electricity by 2032. This is on the books. New York has a 50% renewable electricity law by 2030. And, well, so if I want to summarize, I didn't talk about jobs, but we did and analyze the job creation in all 139 countries and all 50 states, and we find that worldwide we can create 24 million more long-term full-time jobs than lost. In the U.S., it's about 2 million more. We would require only a fifth of a percent of land for footprint for solar PV and CSP with these world energy plans and 0.9% for spacing between wind turbines. We'd avoid 4 to 7 million air pollution deaths per year. We could slow, then eventually reverse global warming. We think we can keep the grid stable throughout the world with 100% renewables. The cost per kilowatt hour is slightly less than that of fossil fuels, but health plus energy plus climate costs are per kilowatt hour are one-fourth that of fossils, and the absolute energy plus climate costs are one-eighth because we're using 50% less energy with the wind, water, solar system. Finally, transitioning to 100% in all energy sectors, we think it's technically and economically possible. The main barriers are social and political. The solution does require collective willpower of everybody, and we can't just do it in isolation with a few examples. Everybody has to help or at least want to help.
That was Mark Jacobson, Director of the Atmosphere and Energy Program at Stanford University. Learn more about Jacobson's vision for moving the nation and the world to 100% renewable energy by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Less than a week after Democrats won back control of the House of Representatives in the November 6 midterm election, some 200 climate activists conducted a sit-in at Democratic leader Nancy Pelosi's office on Capitol Hill. The young activists from the Sunrise Movement and Justice Democrats were joined by newly elected Progressive Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez of New York and demanded that the Democrats make climate change a top priority when their party takes control of the House in January. U.S. Capitol Police arrested 51 protesters during the action. The urgency of addressing climate change comes as the last 4 years have broken all records for the highest global temperatures since climate data was first recorded in 1880. The UN Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change issued a report that warns that the world has only a 10 to 12 year window to take action on climate change. And President Trump's executive order, signed last year, that will dismantle the Obama administration's most far-reaching climate change regulation, the Clean Power Plan. Your reporter spoke with Jeremy Ornstein, an 18-year-old activist with the Sunrise Movement, who talks about his group's sit-in at Nancy Pelosi's congressional office and the demand to develop a comprehensive plan to address climate change, known as the Green New Deal, a progressive vision for environmental sustainability and economic stability.
Speaker Pelosi, or soon to be Speaker Pelosi, proposed after the Democrats flipped the House, proposed the idea for a climate committee that would be bringing back a committee from the mid-2000s. The goal of the committee would be to gather evidence around the climate crisis, and that was all she said. And after working so hard for 6 months trying to elect really largely Democrats to our government,
our movement and, frankly, our generation. A lot of people my age who had voted for the first time were really frustrated because I was a big high school Democrat in my high school years, Scott, and I know that I poured a lot of time and energy into, like, not just electing Democrats, but also organizing people my age to support Democrats. And I have a lot of hope that the Democratic Party will be the vehicle of actually building the political will to stop climate change. But our leadership failed us so vividly when soon-to-be Speaker Pelosi talked about this committee to educate, because we know we've been getting evidence for the past decades. We need action now. And that's what the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, this big group of the world's top climate scientists, says. They said we have 12 years to radically transform our economy and society. So part of the goal of the action was just to expose the gap between what we know we need, between what we fought for over these past 6 months, and what Democratic leadership, what their plan is. In exposing that, to both put pressure on the House leadership, to put pressure on regular members of Congress to get behind a real plan, and to expose this gap between what we want of them and what they're really doing to try and get people to act.
Jeremy, I did want to ask you about one important goal that the group that sat in at Nancy Pelosi's office had, and that was to push the idea of something known as the Green New Deal. Can you explain what the Green New Deal is regarding the environment, climate change, as well as jobs, creating jobs?
Yeah. The Green New Deal is a plan to decarbonize our economy in the next 10 years while creating jobs for anyone who needs one and centering the needs of the communities most impacted by the climate crisis. And so we're envisioning this to be what will really be a sort of very complicated package of legislation. And when we call it the Green New Deal, hearkening back to the New Deal, FDR's New Deal, from the 1930s. And so one element of it will be finding some ways to go shift to 100% renewable in all sectors of our economy, really in the next decade, because that's what this report from the world's top scientists says that this country has to do to like make sure that our world doesn't go past the reversible amounts of global warming, reversible amounts of carbon in the atmosphere. We've got to transition to 100% renewable by 2030. So that's one really important part of the Green New Deal, is that it would make sure the government finds ways to support 100% renewable transition. And a second really crucial part of the Green New Deal is that in coming together to stop this climate crisis, we also want to make sure that this transition is just, and that people who will be losing their jobs, who will be affected by these changes, can also be supported. And that's why part of the Green New Deal is the idea of a job guarantee that, especially in this day and age in this country, and especially when we're fighting something so large as the climate crisis, we're going to need all hands on deck. And that means if one of the proposals in this policy package is if someone needs a job, that they should be able to get a job, a federally funded job, to do something to fight the climate crisis. And part of what's interesting about this is there are so many shovel-ready jobs that got to be filled. You know, updating infrastructure, building walls to protect from rising sea level. These are things that we can give people shovels and help them get to work. And the notion is also that these jobs should have high minimum wage and should have real benefits so that workers can live on them. Over the coming months, we'll be promoting the Green New Deal as a plan to make sure that regular people have a voice and have a part in making it a reality.
That was Jeremy Ornstein, an 18-year-old activist with the Sunrise Movement. Learn more about the Sunrise Movement's campaign to make climate change an urgent priority across America by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our newly designed and mobile-friendly website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on WBSU in Brockport, New York, GDPR in Nashville, Tennessee, KEXP in Seattle, Washington, and dozens of other community stations across the U.S. and abroad. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Ruth Ann Baumgartner, Susan Bramhall, Mary Hunt, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Mumia Abu-Jabal's radio essay.
Polls. If we believe the polls, on November the 6th, a political earthquake is coming. Reporters are almost breathless with tales of blue waves and transformation from one party to another. But if such predictions seem so sure, remember the elections of 2016, when polls proved woefully inadequate. Predictions fell like yesterday's lottery tickets. For polls, ultimately, are snapshots in time, and they can prove fallible to something as simple as the weather. Rain and cold temperatures can depress voting, as the hardiest dare to brave the winds or weather of fortune. We are witness to the politics of fear and hatred of the other, them, those who are not us. But who are we, if not them? It is interesting to see and hear of invaders to these shores. For to the indigenous First Nations, all who now inhabit America, with the possible exception of Africans, are invaders, the refuse of Europe. Here they slaughtered millions of so-called Indians to make Lebensraum, German for living room, for so-called whites. Politics, that great machine of division, can call the people to fear and enmity, or it can call them to unity and common purpose. Time will tell which will prevail. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jabal. These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio. Twilight of Empire. The Trump era, when it finally passes from the stage of history, will not pass either easily nor willingly. It will have left the aura of anxiety, the pangs of paranoia, and the air of enmity. It will be bitter, nasty, and mean, and it will not end with death. It will leave a stench of anger, of hatred and sourness that will long dwell in the national unconscious as well as the memory of the world. Such will be the legacy of Trump. Such will be the unworthy inheritance of the American empire. For the better part of a century, America played the role of protector of the weak and benefactor of the world's oppressed. but that was when the world was a bipolar one. The fall of the Soviet Union made the world unipolar, the world's sole superpower. And with that reality emerged the U.S. without a peer and without a mask. We saw then his true, angry, contemptuous face, snarling at the Third World, hostile to its European ancestors, and dismissive of Latin America. That's because an empire needs no allies, nor any friends. It needs subjects. It needs satraps. Where empires are political, economic, and military machines, dominance and exploitation. Its power is its only justification for being. It matters little whether Trump completes the full 8 years of two terms, or is there for the next 8 months. The die is cast. The empire has sat its utter contempt upon the world. The damage is done. From imprisoned nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio.
President Chaos. This country is a complex place. This world is a complex world. To govern such a place, indeed, such an empire, takes wisdom, insight, and knowledge from the finest minds. And even then, nothing is guaranteed, as shown by the great debacle in Iraq. Iraq was driven by emotion, and emotions can lead to disaster. In America today, the country is led by a man who is led by emotions. It is led by hatred, pique, insecurity, and ego, emotions. Like a child, it can turn on a dime, raging like a wildfire, or as cold as a glacier. Emotions are ultimately unstable. They turn and twist like a weather vane in the wind. President Trump is that weather vane, turning, twisting, blowing. All those who do not embrace him are enemies. All the rest, servants of an unstable mind. Meanwhile, the world looks on in sometimes silent wonder. A few weeks ago, Trump brought his reality show to the General Assembly of the United Nations. In the midst of one of his campaign speeches, the UN burst into laughter, not with him, but at him. These men and women, the world's most esteemed diplomats, were laughing at the President of the United States. We've seen a leader who ignores or berates his advisors, a leader who damns and dogs the press, a leader who treats the Constitution with unbridled contempt. A man at war with his own government. A man at war with himself. A few days ago, millions of Americans delivered a massive rebuke, led mostly by women. I think more will be seen before this is over. While the president stares the cauldron of chaos. From imprisoned nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio.
Mm-hmm.
Who were Cecil Rhodes, Alfred Milner, and Nathan Rothschild, and what roles did they play in orchestrating the First World War? Why did Britain pretend to support and then deliberately undermine ally Russia in its efforts to take over Constantinople? How did elites succeed in concealing the records and facts concerning the start and extension of the Great War? Is the world duplicating the same dynamics that resulted in a major powers conflict a century ago? On this week's Global Research News Hour, as we continue our retrospective coverage of World War I, we discuss and examine the roots of the war to end all wars and the imperial aspirations of British elites. In our first half hour, we hear from Jerry Daugherty about his research into the hidden history of World War I and its secret origins in 19th century London. Then we hear from journalist and anti-war activist Rick Rozoff about the developments on the world stage in 2018 and whether the world may once again be on the path to another devastating conflict. On this week's program, Conspiracy and Cover-Up, the Secret Origins of World War I. Bringing you the analysis beyond the media headlines, the Global Research News Hour is on the air. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of November 23rd, 2018. I'm series host and producer Michael Welch. The Global Research News Hour is a special radio collaboration between the Center for Research on Globalization and campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg on occupied Anishinaabeg, Akin, the homeland of the Métis Nation and the traditional territory of the Nhiyawak and the Nakota. We seek to provide you with access to analysis of the major issues shaping our world today for thinkers, researchers, and unique political personalities rarely addressed by major media. Our program is available from the Center's website, globalresearch.ca. We'll begin our show with news notes, a sampling of articles from the Global Research News site. According to the WAPO report, Langley was aware of the assassination plot, but U.S. intelligence visibly did not act. Quote, "The United States had also obtained intelligence before Khashoggi's death that indicated he might be in danger. But it wasn't until after he disappeared on October 2nd that U.S. intelligence agencies began searching archives of intercepted communications and discovered material indicating that the Saudi royal family had been seeking to lure Khashoggi back to Riyadh." It should be understood that Saudi Arabia's General Intelligence Presidency and the CIA not only exchange classified information, Saudi intelligence has consistently acted as a de facto subsidiary of the CIA, going back to the onset of the Soviet-Afghan War in 1979. The CIA has its staff in Riyadh operating out of the U.S. Embassy, as well as military intelligence personnel on location, collaborating with their counterparts at Saudi Arabia's GIP. That comes from the article, "Who Killed Jamal Khashoggi? Did U.S. Intelligence Have Prior Knowledge?" by Professor Michel Chosudovsky, posted November 22nd. America has bankrupted its economy, its original ideals, and now, after Khashoggi's murder, its sense of decency, its core morality. These are all gone forever. One book that predicted and encapsulated the description of what America was and will be was published in July 2002. It was, in fact, a series of essays written over 10 years. Its name, The Decline and Fall of the American Empire, written by the outstandingly unique genius, the late Gore Vidal. That comes from the article, The Decline of America. Trump protects Saudi Crown Prince MBS. The pillars of the U.S. Constitution are gone. The views of Gore Vidal. By Richard Galustian. Posted November 21st. The CIA and White House are at odds over who's responsible for what happened. Langley's damning conclusion, pointing fingers at Mohammed bin Salman, indicates opposition to his becoming Saudi king. Key for the agency is he displaced a Western intelligence favorite, Mohammed bin Nayef, as well as Langley and some of Riyadh's closest allies, believing he's too reckless and untrustworthy to leave the kingdom when his father, King Salman, passes. Clearly, he ordered Khashoggi's murder, yet Trump and his regime hardliners refuse to lay blame where it belongs, sticking by MBS, despite his reckless actions since becoming crown prince, destabilizing the region more than already. That comes from the article,
Continuing furor over Khashoggi's murder by Stephen Lendman, posted November 21st. NBC News maintains that four sources in U.S. government agencies, probably the FBI and the State Department, told its reporters that the Trump White House is seeking ways to expel Turkish religious leader Fethullah Gulen. But the kicker is that Trump apparently is exploring the extradition as a bribe to shut Turkish President Tayyip Erdogan up about the murder of dissident journalist Jamal Khashoggi on the orders of Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. The Saudis are now trying to pin the blame on lower-level operatives whom they have sentenced to death. But Erdogan has been like a bulldog, insisting that bin Salman ordered the hit, which is the only logical. NBC says that career officials were absolutely furious when they figured out what was behind the White House requests. That comes from the article. Trump said, considering extradition of Turkish cleric to quiet Erdogan on Khashoggi murder, by Juan Cole, posted November 17th, originally appearing at Informed Consent. Turkey has given recordings on the killing of Saudi journalist Jamal Khashoggi to Saudi Arabia, the United States, Germany, France, and Britain, President Tayyip Erdogan said on Saturday. Turkish sources have said previously that authorities have an audio recording purportedly documenting the murder. Speaking ahead of his departure for France to attend commemorations to mark the 100th anniversary of the end of World War I, Erdogan said Saudi Arabia knows the killer of Jamal Khashoggi is among a group of 15 people who arrived in Turkey one day ahead of the October 2nd killing. Khashoggi, a critic of Saudi rulers, was killed inside the Saudi consulate in Istanbul. Saudi Arabia has admitted he was murdered there, but denied suggestions its royal family was involved. That comes from the article. Five countries listened to Khashoggi murder tapes, Erdogan says. Posted November 12th, originally appearing at Times of Malta. On November 20th, U.S. President Donald Trump released a long-awaited official statement on the murder of Saudi opposition journalist Jamal Khashoggi by the Saudi government in a Saudi consulate in the Turkish city of Istanbul on the 2nd of October. The statement came amid reports from CIA-linked sources that it was Saudi Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman who had ordered the killing of the journalist and the official stance of the Turkish investigation that the order to kill the journalist had come from the highest level of the Saudi government. Additionally, U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo held a press briefing saying that Washington's relations with Saudi Arabia won't be affected by the Khashoggi case because, quote, this is a long historic commitment and one that is absolutely vital to America's national security, unquote. So, kill journalists, invade other countries, support al-Qaeda, and order death penalties for witchcraft. That is all fine as long as there is some U.S., quote-unquote, historic commitment at your back. That comes from the article under the headline, Video, Trump Releases Official Statement on Khashoggi Murder, Points Finger at Iran, posted November 21st, originally appearing at South Front. These are just a few of the featured articles appearing last week on the Global Research website. Regular visitors to the site are encouraged to send monetary contributions by fax, mail, or online. Just go to globalresearch.ca and click Donate on the menu bar. This month, November 2018, we mark the centenary of Armistice Day, the official end of World War I. The four-year-long conflict was allegedly triggered by the assassination of Austro-Hungarian heir Archduke Franz Ferdinand in Sarajevo. Serbia's failure to reply to Austria-Hungary's ultimatum put them on a war footing, and interlocking alliances with larger powers pulled other powers into the fray, making it a truly world war. One astounding counter-narrative, however, comes from researcher Jerry Daugherty. He alleges that World War I had been planned more than two decades previously by a cabal in London, and that the war was principally a drive to extend and secure the dominance of the British Empire. Jerry Daugherty is a graduate of Edinburgh University and a retired secondary school teacher. He taught economics and modern studies. He's also a playwright, having written a number of plays with a historical theme. Having been energized by the research undertaken to write his last play, he connected with researcher Jim McGregor and began a 10-year quest to reveal the hidden history of World War I. The two co-authored Hidden History, The Secret Origin of the First World War in 2014, published by Mainstream Publishing, Edinburgh and London, and in 2018 published a sequel, Prolonging the Agony, How the Anglo-American Establishment Deliberately Extended World War I by 3.5 years. That was published by Trinday. Jerry Docherty joined us by phone from his home in Scotland. Could you explain to our listeners how you first came to question the official account?
The first fault, really, was the simplicity in the account, which more or less suggests that a single assassination of a very little-known archduke precipitated a cataclysmic world disaster. It's just so simple. It's a kind of throwaway piece of information which is possibly taught to juniors in school. And yet it has survived in the psyche of millions and millions of learned people as the quick, simple response to what caused the First World War. When analyzed, it really does not stand any test of veracity whatsoever. Indeed, the action took place, of course it did. Only erupted into something far more cataclysmic because of all the background preparations which this secret group, we call them the secret elite, had previously ensured was in place for any such event which could tip the world into this tragedy from which and in which Germany would be crushed.
Okay. So could you give us an example of some of these, you know, that level of sophistication that assassination explanation doesn't adequately address?
Well, first of all, I'd like to praise the amazing American researcher and historical writer whose initial work really exposed everything which was happening in that century, Carol Quigley. And Carol Quigley was party to a considerable amount of secret British-American documentation, which he was clearly threatened with severe consequences if he made public. He did write the book in which all of this was laid out before observers, and inside his great work, The Anglo-American Establishment, inside that book he says, look, follow the clues, follow the money, follow all these persons that I have mentioned, and you will see what was really happening. And when Jim McGregor and I began to really try to get under the skin of what was going on at the time and who these people in London, initially, where it was a fact. So much else had happened and was happening. So much was being orchestrated by a small group of very elite friends, associates, people who were of high level, either finance or birth or political influence. And these people were directly responsible for setting all of the parameters within which this horrendous war could take place for the sole purpose, for the main purpose of dictating a world policy which would see Germany crushed and the British Empire completely vindicated and drawn strength and strength. And that group also initially had dreams of reconquering America, as they saw it. But essentially, America's economic strength was so great that angle was changed so that it was to encompass and include the elite of American banking, financing, political society, the men who acted behind the scenes in order to more or less dictate a policy which would have effects across the whole world, and which in time would settle a new world order which more or less disbanded all of these historic empires across Europe and create a new world order. Mm. The power center for this, the initial money man behind it all was Cecil Rhodes from British South Africa, the man who owned the beers and the gold mines, a great associate and friend and ally of the Rothschilds, who were also very heavily involved in South Africa, a man of immense, immense wealth, who gathered together a very elite group of Oxford-based politicians. He had a huge admiration for Oxford University and the thinking of the philosophers who had come through that university process. And he believed, as did those he chose to surround himself with, that there was almost a race elite of English men whose influence on the world was so important that this is what the world needed. It needed these men to take control, to direct the whole of the future of the economic and social and developmental structure in the world, that they should be doing it. It should be up to these people. And initially, and because it has to start somewhere, he used his great wealth and in fact, his last will and testament to enable those who followed him to pursue such a policy. And naming names, Cecil Rhodes and Nathan Rothschild, and a most important man, I would argue, in the 20th century, especially in the first half of the 20th century, Alfred Milner, a name whom many of your listeners will never have heard of before. But Alfred Milner was central to this group. He was a man of steel. He called himself an English race patriot, and he was willing to take the steps to create circumstances which, in the end, would result in Germany being crushed. He admitted to having initiated all of the circumstances which caused the Boer War, so that horrendous possibility that these Boer farmers might rebuke and throw out the might of the empire in South Africa was the first step in actually daring to create a situation where the helm of state, the helm of this great ship of wealth and determination would be steered for the next century. Mm-hmm. And Alfred Milner not only helped and enabled the Boer War to begin, but when he came home, though he was very unpopular with politicians, that does not stop these people. When he came home, he dedicated most of the rest of his life before the First World War to actually preparing the British Empire, visiting Canada, and any of the outposts where he could influence people to prepare to back the mother country, that is Britain, in a war to come, and that would be against Germany. And he drove that as a passion, as a zealot. And in the end, it absolutely shocked me that I didn't know before I started this research. But at the end of the war, from 1916 to 18, and beyond, Alfred Milner, unelected, was a member of the inner war cabinet, which was led by David Lloyd George. Here he was, the man who admitted to causing the Boer War, but by the end of World War One was actually a leading influence in the inner war cabinet of the British Empire. And you know what, Michael? He's been airbrushed from history. A man of such incredible dynamic importance, airbrushed from history. Only now, only in the 21st century, are a few scholars beginning to pull back the evidence, to further research and to appreciate the incredible power that this man exerted. Because it was considered not to be something they wanted people to realize.
Jerry, just to back up a little bit, you did mention the Cecil Rhodes and his the wealth, the gold and diamond wealth that he'd accrued, and so that certainly gave them the means In addition to the what you mentioned, Oxford University is a sort of a major intellectual center. At the same time, they're also a unique set of circumstances in terms of the networks that were established, and you mentioned that with Alfred Milner, that enabled these elite moneyed interests to go beyond, to essentially overtake what the political powers, the sort of the, what we are used to thinking of as the major political powers. Giving them even more power to those moneyed elites and taking it to the international level. I have to ask, first of all, this enmity toward Germany. I think you alluded to sort of a racialized character here, but I just want to probe a little bit more. What was it about Germany that would evoke that need to crush them, as opposed to, say, the United States? Why would those elites not be able to establish formal ties with Germany, whereas they could with the United States and France and Russia? What was the specific threat posed by Germany that would cause this decades long plot?
Basically, Michael, it was economic. The rise of Germany as a nation state after 1871 brought with it a huge economic revival, and Germany was spreading its goods and its services, its exports across the world, and threatening the British economy. And it became very clear at the turn of the century that the economy which was driving forward was that of Germany. It had had a later starting base than the British technological revolution. And that was very, very worrying, because people in power did not want to see the empire under any kind of economic threat whatsoever. America at this point was not viewed as a nation which wanted to have its own empire. It wasn't viewed in that way. So, and in many ways, of course, there were positive economic links there which were growing. The other thing about Germany which was a bit problematic wasn't that the Kaiser was one of Queen Victoria's favorites. She was probably... No, she was undoubtedly the monarch in Europe whom she liked best. He was, I can't remember precisely what the relationship was, but I'll catch up with that in a minute. The Kaiser was an emperor, and she absolutely respected him. He loved her, in fact, and he visited her, and in truth, and this will surprise many, many of your listeners, he actually was the man in whose hands Queen Victoria died. He was with her in the room of the Isle of Wight in her private residence when she died in 1901. And that, of course, was something which was, again, kept very much from the people. And what we see in the propaganda of the time was a realization that that Germany, and it became personalized on Kaiser Wilhelm, that Germany was this threat to the absolute dominance of the British Empire and the British economy. And it became focused also on a notion, a really false notion, that the Germans had embarked on an arms race in shipping, in battleships, that the Germans were threatening to master the British Navy on the high seas. Now, of course, when you think of the economic links of the time and the importance of naval passages and all of that, it got to ridiculous points where governments were threatened unless they kept producing more of these great dreadnoughts and battleships than Germany was producing. It became a hugely important political issue because it epitomized the fear of the whole, let me think of the right word here, Michael. It epitomized the threat as was perceived, as was absolutely encouraged by the propagandists in terms of what Germany's aims were, that the assumption that Germany intended to take over the world economically and perhaps even more so, because people who have their own secret agendas often visit them on others in order to create a false impression.
Now, there's a very important point that you make, that of American involvement, and I think probably one of the most important turning points was the sinking of the Lusitania, which I believe has been exposed to have been, you know, I guess you might refer to as a, well, that is not, basically it was shot by a German gunboat, and that this has just been portrayed as an act of barbarity, among other, propaganda that's being, penetrating the consciousness of Americans and people around the world about the barbarity of the Germans, even though you present a very different picture here. Could you give us a little bit more background on that, the American connection?
The whole issue with the Lusitania was that war had begun and war had to be justified. That every turn, America was hugely important. There were in America a considerable number of people who genuinely did not want to be in the war or have anything to do with the war, who considered it quite correctly to be a European war and took that stance very firmly. There were huge numbers of German Americans, of Irish Americans, who deeply, deeply distrusted the British government. It was a sorry time in many ways. So every ounce of propaganda that could be focused on America was. The Lusitania was perhaps the greatest single effort made to draw America into the war as early as 1915 in order to have access to all of the money, resources, the huge industrial power that stemmed from America, the armaments, the munitions, etc. Lusitania was, in fact, not a simple passenger liner. She had been created in the Royal Navy Auxiliary. A considerable amount of money had been spent in having her decked out with secret capacity to carry cargo. And she was, in fact, regularly carrying a great deal of munitions from the United States to Britain, and that in itself was hugely, hugely important to the survival of the British Army and its capacity to actually fight in Europe. Even more important, it carried Americans. And it was perfectly plain, perfectly obvious to the Germans from their own people in the United States, in New York, that, in fact, munitions were being loaded onto this liner on a regular basis. And they took the very firm step of saying, stop this. This must stop. The Lusitania is being, her neutrality, and American neutrality is being abused. And in fact, we have to warn you that this boat will be sunk if she continues performing in the manner in which she did, acting more or less as a service ship for the British cause. This was ignored. And in Britain, they knew that the German submarines were out looking for the Lusitania, and they actually took action to make sure that the Lusitania had no protection whatsoever as she approached the coast of Ireland in May 1915.
You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcasting from CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and from partnering radio stations across Canada and the United States.
Well, I think one very important battle or front was the attempt to the campaign, the Gallipoli campaign, and that Russia had an interest in basically in invading Turkey and or attacking Turkey, and the Brits sort of made sure that they wanted to make it look like they were supporting the Russian perspective, the Russian plan, but made sure that it would not succeed. What motivated them to take that particular course that they did? Because it was a pretty significant, from the standpoint of Russian, making sure that Russia was on side with Britain and France in this war.
Yeah. In many ways, I thoroughly understand anyone who rushes into a conclusion that is impossible. It could not have happened. But let me point to a few facts. Firstly, it was assumed that Russia would sweep in from the east, and there were so many men in the Russian army that there would be a tidal wave across coming from the east, which would sink the Germans, and the British and French together coming from the west would do likewise, and the war would be over. Initially, of course, the great claim was the war will be over by Christmas. Right. It wasn't. The Russian army was exceptionally weak. Although they had men, they didn't have the proper munitions. They didn't have a structure which promoted good judgment in their generals. They were all tied to the royal family and to nobility. And the Russian army suffered massive setbacks in the first 2 years. The Tsar was asking the question to the British representative in St. Petersburg, which was then the capital, what's in it for us? You know, we've lost millions of men, and there's going to be nothing in it for us. The great golden carrot was Constantinople. Now, Constantinople, at the bottom of the Black Sea, was the gateway between the Black Sea and the Mediterranean. It would have given Russia what it didn't have, which was, in her whole empire, it would give her a warm water port. She would be able to negotiate and trade and travel right the way through the world for the first time. The British had no intention from step one, absolutely none, of ever allowing this, but they committed themselves to do it in order to make sure that Russia was tied into the war. So, 2 years on, by 1915-16, Lord, something had to be done to convince the Russians, because the whole of the Western Front had seized up in the mud of Flanders, and this was looking particularly bad. So it was decided that they would revert to a plan which had been discarded about 5 years before the war took over, which was to send in the great naval ships up the Dardanelles and through the very narrow straits into Constantinople, and the theory was they would, the Turks would surrender when the great battleships trained their guns on their capital. Now, the reason why it had been discarded in 1911 was the realization of how easy it is to mine, first of all, the progress of the great battleships, and also there were great gun batteries up on the Dardanelles, up on the heights, which made any kind of attack extremely, extremely difficult. Yet the Russians had to be won over. And so a full initiative was eventually forced on Kitchener, the General Kitchener, who was obviously in charge of the War Office in the British Army, accepted the need to be seen to be doing something. So he appointed one of the least efficient, one of the least experienced of his generals to give the lead on the attack on the Dardanelles to attack Turkey. And believe it or not, Michael, so ill-prepared with this, with General Hamilton, he didn't have any prior information. He didn't have the most recent reports from all of that area, from British agents. They didn't even have maps that were sufficiently accurate. They were actually scouring the markets of Cairo in Egypt to try and get as up-to-date maps as they could find before the invasion took place. It is so ridiculous that it's embarrassing.
Mm.
Now, of course, the Turks could see this whole invasion coming. They were well prepared for it. It led to an enormous loss of life, much of which was pitiless in it. These young men who were thrown onto the beaches under these guns, many of them had not insufficient water. Many of them died from hydration, dehydration, and other illnesses. It was a shocking affair. But when the Russian generals saw this happening, they came to the conclusion that, yes, they're doing something. They're going to take Constantinople for us. It reassured the Russians, and that was its point.
Mm. Now, I wanted to move on to the other aspect of this that equally interesting is the you call it the cover-up. You mentioned the researcher, Carol Quigley. I know that he's got two books, The Anglo-American Establishment and Tragedy and Hope, The History of the World.
Two great books, yeah.
And they're not easy to find.
Let's start with Carol Quigley, because he was a very brave man. He was part of the American establishment, and he was a well-liked and loved professor. In fact, Bill Clinton referred to him in his acceptance speech when he was nominated by the Democratic Party. And Carol Quigley realized that what he had stumbled upon, what he had been given access to see, what he eventually was writing about, was so sensitive that he feared that his life was in danger. And he actually said so on a radio interview that he gave in 1974, where he explained how he had come by the information, and he became quite animated in this expose and warned the radio host to be very careful what was being said because what he actually used because there were powers around in the 1970s which would according to him which would endanger their lives. What he discovered was that in the spring of 1966, the publishers Macmillan were planning to issue Tragedy and Hope. And in the summer of 1966, Macmillan was bought by, the company was bought by a holding company and stopped all advertising of Quigley's book. Tragedy and Hope got a quarter page advert in the New York Times, and that was all. In fact, everything about it was cut back. It was supposed to go out in reprint in 1968. Collier Books bought out the last half of the book, but never told them, and it was allowed to go out of print, and they promised them that something would be done, that it was just temporarily out of stock. And then he discovered that they weren't going to print it at all, that his contacts told them that he couldn't get the plates had been damaged, and in fact, there was no way that the book would see light of day again. I mean, this is a direct attempt just to simply stop the book being published. And that interference in the right of people to know and to speak their mind, it runs against the American Constitution, but that so be that. That was one of the things which was of great importance to actually keeping this out of people's awareness, so that the traditional history could continue to be taught.
Could you talk about the efforts to go to the different countries and round up all those incriminating documents and either seal them off from public view or destroy them outright.
Perhaps the greatest single theft of knowledge and information was that which was perpetrated at the end of the First World War through and by Herbert Hoover, who had been the man responsible in leading the so-called Belgian Relief Fund or American Relief in Belgium. What Hoover and his associates did was they began to collect and collate hundreds of thousands of pieces of evidence, anything to do with the war, especially those days before the war, whole screeds of German official papers disappeared, of Russian correspondence disappeared, and the story given about was that what Hoover was doing and his associates as they were collecting all of the evidence so that history wouldn't lose it, and they were sending it back to America, and in fact it was destined to go to Stanford University in California, where it would all be safely collated and it would be safeguarded for the world. In fact, what was happening was that, I mean, we're talking about so much stock that it filled ballasts in cargo ships going back from Europe to America. I mean, you're talking about an enormous mountain of evidence which was taken away, anything at all to do with the workings of the so-called Belgian Relief Fund, anything to do with those who had been in correspondence in the days before the war, anything which would have pointed to a different storyline that they wanted to promulgate through the Treaty of Versailles, and that was basically that it was all Germany's fault. All of this was scooped out of Europe and taken away.
And
so, I mean, it's unique. It's unique in history that a deliberate effort was taken to absolutely clear out volumes and volumes of evidence of goodness knows what, because we've never really been given sight of it. And the promise was that it would probably take about 2 years to get all this sifted through. Well, it didn't take anything. It's still not fully. We still don't know the full extent of what was taken or by whom and how it was treated.
Now, one other thing that I think seems very counterintuitive is the case of Russia and their participation in the cover-up. Because in the time, I mean, we had there was an anti-war movement in Russia that would seem, you'd think that when the Bolsheviks took over, like, what interest do they have in supporting the cover-up of the truth about World War One? Could you outline that for us?
Yeah. You have to remember the absolute confusion of that time. The stepping down, the abdication of the Tsar, and then the various governments, which eventually ended up with Lenin and Trotsky, whose whole arrival back in Russia was a feature of sublime cleverness by powers that be throughout Europe to be able to get these two men in particular who would foment revolution into the top spots was almost unprecedented itself as well. But the truth of the matter was that Russia, Lenin in particular, had a problem with armaments, had a problem with finances, had a problem with being able to ensure that they could win the internal civil war in Russia. So therefore, they needed money, and money was more important than virtually anything else. They needed to exchange their money for ammunition, for guns, for the wages of war. And this they did. They made it very easy for information to be collected from Russia. They weren't interested particularly in such information. They were more interested in the price it could get them in order to finance their own civil war. So there was a period of in Russian history of that time, and no one knew for sure who was about to win this horrendous struggle that was going on. And in the midst of it, a very interesting group like American Red Cross had visited the Russian government, the new Russian government, and the people who were on that Red Cross group were financiers from the Morgan, the Rockefeller, the Wall Street powers, which is a strange group to have as representatives of the American Red Cross. So we can safely assume that something other than the good of the injured and the ill was taking place. So inside that confusion and inside that time scale, a great deal of the archives from Russia were also easily sifted out. It was said by Hoover when he was asked how easy it had been to get hold of all of the vast estates of records that he had collected and was taking to the United States. It's very easy to get starving people to say yes.
Jerry Dougherty, we're kind of running to close to the end of our time, but I wanted to make sure you had a chance to speak a little bit to the combination of carrots and sticks that conspire to prevent honest researchers from you revealing some of these inconvenient truths about World War I and the way history has unraveled since, and maybe some of the ways that researchers are co-opted into continuing this cover-up.
Yeah, I think that the university system has set up over the last century has enabled those in charge of the courses and the departments in the greatest universities in the land to dictate what is and what is not accepted as a historical fact. So that when students are writing essays, they're given the accepted reviews and evidence to use in their work. When lecturers come forward, they are using orthodox explanations, and anyone who steps out of line, who goes towards unacceptable history in the eyes of these people, well, they probably have their tenures cut, possibly forever. And when you've got wife, family, house, mortgage, and all the trappings, it really takes more than courage to actually stand up and say, well, there is another side to this. Can I ask you to look at or tell the students that they should perhaps be looking at other sources which, especially as the 20th century developed, became more and more available, both online, through research, and through governments deciding that 50, 80, 100 years was long enough to keep some of these documents out of circulation. And that has had a lasting effect on what we accept as orthodox history.
Well, Jerry Dougherty, I wish you had more time to speak, because I think I do see some parallels with what some of us independent journalists have to go through. You know, we get labeled conspiracy theorists or fake news or whatever.
Yeah.
All in the same that same spirit of trying to conceal, so the authentic record. Jerry Dougherty, thank you so much for your time.
My pleasure, Michael. Thank you.
Researcher Jerry Dougherty is the co-author of two books on World War I and its origins. You can find more of his writings at the site firstworldwarhiddenhistory.wordpress.com. It's been 100 years after the end of World War I. NATO forces have been encroaching on Russia's borders since the collapse of the Soviet Union. Conflict has increased since 9/11. President Trump has pulled the U.S. out of the Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Treaty, months after Russia announced a new generation of arsenals, including hypersonic missiles and nuclear payloads, and with the capability of overcoming any and all conventional defenses. There are international tensions amid threats of sanctions, trade disputes, and a precarious global economy. On the centenary of Armistice Day, has anything been learned that might spare the world another major conflict, or is World War III right around the corner? Joining us by phone is Rick Rozoff. He's a journalist, anti-war activist, and manages the Stop NATO listserv. Thanks for joining us, Rick.
Thank you for having me, Michael.
Rick, on November 11th of this year, world leaders gathered in Paris to commemorate the 100th anniversary of the war to end all wars. Your quick take on the Paris Armistice Day event, what signals, if any, do we need to pick up on from what was said and done at that meeting?
There are procedural issues of precedence, if you will, that I think the mainstream media has been very good at following up on. I think an overall assessment of that gathering, decisively, historically decisive event that it was, is that it was covered as little as it was. The world press and particularly political commentators globally have said as little as they did about it. And what we saw was simply a triumphalist, self-congratulatory orgy of the winning side, if you will, and now they're reconciled partners in countries like Germany, celebrating their great victory for democracy. It was, as you recall at the time, touted as by Woodrow Wilson here in the United States as a war to foster democracy globally, as it was a war to end all wars. In both cases, that those claims are flagrantly and patently belied by the events of the time and thereafter. As a matter of fact, far from fostering democracy in Europe, several countries that had embarked on a democratic parliamentary system in Europe, shortly thereafter, saw them go by the wayside. I'm thinking of Russia, Italy, Germany, and other countries. So it hardly, the war hardly was meant to introduce and promote democracy, nor as we sadly know, did it affect its alleged claim of ending further wars. It didn't, if anything, exacerbated the situation in Europe so that World War II was inevitable.
Mm. Well, what is your take on the announcement, the earlier announcement about developing a European army to protect against China, Russia, and even the U.S., and what would that mean for NATO?
I mean, this statement could only have emanated from the mouth of President Macron of France, bank stooge that he is. That's an absolutely inane comment, of course. How a European army would defend itself against China is mind-boggling. Against the United States is simply inane. Against Russia is quite more to the point. But we have to keep in mind that since 1999, that is when the North Atlantic Treaty Organization became for the first time, on a major scale, involved in the war-making business, that is the 78-day air war against Federal Republic of Yugoslavia, they held their 50th anniversary jubilee a meeting in Washington, D.C., to celebrate their great victory of NATO expansion, war against an unoffending country outside its area of responsibility. But they also exposed or unveiled a program called Berlin Plus. I invite your listeners to look it up. It's a program between the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, European Union, for joint military collaboration. This is what Macron is really speaking about. So we have no doubts about these sorts of things. He's talking about an adjunct to NATO under EU auspices, something comparable to the European Union naval blockade in the Persian Gulf and off the Horn of Africa, or more particularly the European Union battle groups. So that what you see is that not only military ordnance bases, but commanders are interchangeable between NATO and the European Union. That's what he's talking about. And clearly, of the three countries he mentioned, let us assume that China and the United States certainly are simply camouflage to disguise the otherwise glaring fact that he's talking about a continental army to be deployed against Russia.
Hmm. Well, given the state of international tension currently, what potential flashpoint or development are you most focused on lately that you feel is most likely to deliberately or accidentally trigger a major powers conflict?
That's a hard choice to make, isn't it, Michael? I mean, unfortunately, there seems to be an embarrassment of riches in that respect. I would say if we're talking about the situation in Europe, continental Europe, it's clearly going to be between the U.S. and its NATO allies to the west and Russia to the east. There is no other potential challenger. We have to recollect just a few weeks ago, NATO held, with active U.S. involvement, of course, held the largest war games since the Cold War, since the collapse of the Soviet Union and the dissolution of the Warsaw Pact in Norway, right off the Russian coast, of course, 50,000 troops, all sorts of warplanes, warships, and so forth. implication is pretty obvious as to who they were preparing to defend themselves against. So that flashpoints of Baltic Sea is potentially one. Crimea, should the West insert itself there and try to exacerbate some sort of international conflict around that. Ukraine, surely. Black Sea. There are any number of the Caucasus. There are any number of places where the U.S. and its allies might provoke a conflict with Russia, so it's hard to say. Some of this could be a matter of accident. We were talking about World War One, of course. It was Gavril Princip shot the Archduke Ferdinand in Sarajevo, and the war began, which is not to say the war wasn't planned by all the major would-be belligerents or future belligerents, but that was the occasion. That was the spark
right.
that set it off. And it could be any number of those areas I mentioned, perhaps some we haven't even considered. But the fact is, once the plans are in place, what happens is actually more pretext than precipitant.
I see. Well, you know, things do seem to be looking pretty grim right now. I mean, economic and political forces seem to be driving us to more military violence. Are there any past triumphs that, because I want to try to end on a positive note, are there any past triumphs that convinces you that the world can turn back from the brink, or are we confronting the inevitable?
Well, you raise a fascinating point. We know about the crises that flare up. We don't know so much about those that are prevented, almost by definition. So who knows? You know, how many times we've been on the brink of something fairly catastrophic and wiser heads prevailed and somebody pulled us back. Cuban Missile Crisis obviously comes to mind. There could be others, but we're sitting on a powder keg, quite literally. And the concern right now is not so much that we try to preempt any particular conflict from arising or crisis from arising, as the need for, first of all, we're talking about a world right now where the U.S. has been, as you indicated in your lead-in comments, has been at war since at least 2011, or 2001, I would make it 1999. So for 20 years, a full generation of Americans have not known peace, and the world has not known peace. And the fact that we don't have a vibrant, thriving, effective peace movement at all in Canada or the United States and Europe and worldwide is I would say, the first thing that needs to be addressed. We need to make peace the preeminent issue in the world. Every other issue, every other initiative that doesn't include a peace or a disarmament, demilitarization component is being negligent in its responsibility for addressing any other issue on the planet. That's the overriding one. Look, Michel Chasudovsky has an article today on global research where he talks about the fatalities. He estimates, I think, 14 million in World War One, 40 million in World War II. I think there's probably low-end figures in both cases. And then dares to posit, what would the casualties of World War III be? They would be incalculable. We're talking in the hundreds of millions, surely. And, with something that horrifying, that the whole world is not united in not only opposing, given war itself, a hypothetical war, but but in ensuring that that possibility doesn't exist, cannot exist. That's my plea.
Well, I guess we've got our work cut out for us. Rick Rozoff, thank you so much for sharing your views with our listeners.
Yeah, thank you, Michael.
We've been speaking with Rick Rozoff, a journalist, anti-war activist, and manager of the Stop NATO listserv. He joined us from Chicago.
You've been listening to the Global Research News Hour. You can listen to our programs every week on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and on partnering radio stations across Canada and the United States. You can also download each episode from the website globalresearch.ca. To leave feedback on this program, email globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com. I'm series host, creator, and producer Michael Welch. Join us again next week.